a sci-fi classic finally arrives on the big screen, a forgotten Disney animated film, and what's this? A Christmas movie just in time for Halloween? This week on 302010. 302010, 302010. 3 decades, every show, sometimes associated videos. 302010, 302010. Surprises and excitement, yes, we're going to the 90s and 2000s and 2010s. On 302010. Hello, everyone, and welcome to 302010, the LaserTime Network's weekly pop culture time machine. And I'm just going to say our official Halloween edition of 302010, where, oh, every week we look at the world.
Would you say this is Halloween?
This is the Halloween edition of the show. I'm going to repeat that 80,000 more times, 2 hours long. Ooh. Yes. Hi, that was a little tease. I rarely do a tease at the top, but I'm one of your hosts, Chris Santista. Who else is with me?
I'm Diana Goodman here on the Jury of the Damned with Benedict Arnold, Lizzie Borden, Richard Nixon, John Wilkes Booth, Blackbeard the Pirate, John Dillinger, and the starting lineup of the 76 Philadelphia Flyers.
And I'm J.R. Rawls, and kidnap the podcast host, throw them in the booth, tie them to the microphone, make them spill the truth. Oh. Kidnap the podcast host, make them spill the beans. We'll get all the facts from behind the scenes.
Yeah. All right, you have to know what's coming up on this episode, because holy crap, is it perhaps one of the biggest Christmas movies? Yeah, that's where I'm going with this. That is a Christmas movie, motherfuckers.
Shots fired. Yeah. This is going to be an even bigger debate on the Facebook page than the shoe argument from Sex and the City.
Oh, goodness. And maybe I have a but it's more of a binary question later on that I want to pose to you guys. Can't wait. Welcome to 302010, the LaserTime Network show, where we look back at the world 30, 20, and 10 years ago from this week. This week being October 27th through November 2nd. Halloween right in the middle there. We're going to look back 3 decades, 30, 20, and 10 years ago, beginning in 1993, 2003, and 2013. Get it? A lot of stuff we're going to rattle off. Sorry if we can't talk about your favorite stuff. Let's get it started with 1993. 30 years ago, October 27th through the 2nd of November. Hold up a little.
I have a theme. I have a theme already. Now, okay. The big movie that we're going to talk about is something that had a very slow growth. You know, yeah. It did well in the theaters, and it built and built and built, and then became a huge thing. This is the opposite. 30 years later.
Yeah. A legacy burned, tarnished, drip dried. Oh, man. Rudy Giuliani wins the New York mayoral election, becoming the first Republican mayor since 1965.
So there's a saying, don't ruin your obituary. Okay. This is when you've done something famous, but you are so desperate to have power, so desperate to still be relevant, that you're just willing to do anything. And that just kind of just kicks your earlier achievements to the back burner when your obituary comes. And that's Rudy's story. You know, if he would have just retired in 2010, he'd be in all the biopics about 9/11. There would be all these for the next century. Anytime the 9/11 movie, miniseries, whatever comes out, they're going to throw in a quick Giuliani. But now every fictional portrayal of Rudy Giuliani is going to end at the Four Seasons Lawn and Garden press release.
Borat's daughter's hotel room. Way more embarrassing. See, the only thing I would that I think is really funny about this, I'm not disputing that, JR, but remember that none of us on the show are New Yorkers. We triangulate the United States, but not there. I want a docuseries on Rudy Giuliani before he dies and have him comment on all this stuff. The stories that come out from people who knew him in New York, hey, guess what? Any legislation you made 30 years ago probably looks a little bad. Too corporate friendly. Not friendly to other people. Not beyond that, he has always been a weirdo and an attention whore. And he embarrassing stories from people who were in the New York area from way back during this time. We noticed him during 9/11 because he was kind of became like, remember when
America's
we liked that
mayor.
That Cuomo guy a little while during COVID, and then he fell from grace too. he became like a rock for the nation, but without really ever doing anything. He didn't do much to help 9/11, did he? He just kind of walked around and like, ah, I'll give up my mayorship anyway. But like, so many silly stories. He's been in so
and
many SNL-style sketches.
Stories. pretty gross fucking stories.
Tons of gross stories.
People gross lawsuits right now.
Mm-hmm. A lifelong horrible totally guy desperate for relevance and attention. And
I'm totally with JR. If he just was retired and had nothing to do with Trump or Trump's campaign or any of Trump's stuff, people would talk about him in the future in reference to 9/11 and urban planning. People would look at him and compare him favorably to Robert Moses. And that would be about it. They would talk about the gentrification of Times Square. They would talk about stop and frisk and broken windows policing.
And huge fall in crime rate in New York happened under his watch. It happened all over the country for various reasons, but it was under his watch. I mean, pre-Giuliani New York isn't insane. You look at some of the pre-Giuliani movies in New York. Oh, yeah. It's scuzzy. It is like dirty. You can almost smell the piss through the screen.
I want to give a shout out to my favorite filthy New York movie, Shaft. We lost Richard Roundtree this week.
And, R.I.P.
It's a good one to watch if you want to see what JR's talking about. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Shut it looks like your mouth.
Well, let's get into some even sadder news. We lost River Phoenix this week, 30 years ago. 30 years ago this week, he dies outside the Viper Room in Los Angeles. Heroin?
Heroin and cocaine. Speedball.
Ah, Speedball.
He was there. He had been partying a whole bunch with various members of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. They were doing a show. He was part of a band with them. Viper Room co-owner Johnny Depp. He was there with his girlfriend Samantha Mathis and his brother Joaquin and his sister Rain. He says, I'm not feeling really well. I might be ODing. And they're like, wow. You're still standing, so you can't be ODing. And then he's like, okay, I'm going to go get some fresh air. Plopped. Just down.
Wow.
Yeah. 23.
23.
Yeah, I was 15 in 1993 at this time. So 23 was still an older actor to me. Yeah. But, you know, I loved young Indy in Last Crusade. And River Phoenix was young Indy. He was like, oh my gosh, I can picture myself being young Indiana Jones. Therefore, I like this River Phoenix character. And this is the first like young celebrity I recall dying.
Yeah. And it felt like he'd been around forever.
Because he had.
Because he did Stand By Me when he's like 15, 16.
Yeah. That's the only movies I watch with River Phoenix in them on the reg now are Stand By Me and to a lesser extent Explorers. But it is interesting to look at him like, he is, in Stand By Me, he is on a different level of skill and emotional conveyance than any of those kids are. Mm-hmm. And those kids turned out to be very talented. There's some sophistication to this child actor. That's why we all had our eye on him. And Explorers, like, he's doing hard into a nerd character. Overshadowed by the great Ethan Hawke.
Yeah, I got to shout Mosquito Coast, another place where he plays young Harrison Ford. He plays Harrison Ford's son in there. He's really, really good. And My Own Private Idaho, which I have my issues with that movie. He is, again, it's like he's on another level in that movie.
And I do want to point out what we got denied. He was supposed to be in Interview with a Vampire.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
He was the Christian Slater role.
Christian Slater part, yeah. Yeah, there were a lot of things that ended up like, well, we just never get that movie. Like, they didn't even try. But, I mean, Gus Van Sant was talking to him about Milk. Back then, Milk didn't get made until, 2008?
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, if I had to say anyone benefited from this, it's Leonardo DiCaprio. That's the career River Phoenix would have had, I think.
Mm, that's fucked up to think about, but yeah.
Well, River Phoenix was James Cameron's original choice to play Jack in Titanic.
Oh, wow. He would have been so good.
Wouldn't he?
He would have been good. Sleeping on the street a lot faster than I can believe Leonardo DiCaprio sleeping on the street. Because River Phoenix did not have a good life, even before the drugs started. He was raised in a cult called Children of God, where they moved to Venezuela, where he was abused when he was 4. And then finally his parents left that cult, thank God. But there was some real fucked up shit going on in that cult. You don't really want to look into it. And then he started helping pay for his family to survive with all the big
piles of
siblings. Did you look at Children of God?
I am. And
it's horrible. It is. It is a cult based around sexual abuse of children.
I am not going to tell you this, listeners, but I am looking at what River Phoenix personally went through.
Yeah.
Holy crud. I am shocked.
It's bad. And it sounds like he came out of all of this mostly okay, a lot more okay than most of us would. And the drugs only started sort of later. He was not really a druggy guy. He did not have a long-standing addiction problem. I mean, he had just sort of started partying, and that shit'll get you.
I don't know. I haven't done heroin, I don't think, personally. Who does it in public?
Celebrities.
What the fuck? I mean,
who will just be able to get away with it? If you're seeing, you know...
Oh, I've seen people do heroin. It's just like, that is like, do you want to become one with a couch? That's what heroin does to you.
And yeah, I've never understood. I don't understand speedballs at all. Like, why do I want to be up and down at the same time?
Yeah.
I kind of want one. I've done legal heroin in an emergency room I was given, Dilaudid, which is just heroin. And it feels fucking great. And I understand why people do it.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't, because it's never going to be that good again.
It's true.
That first time, it will never be that good again.
Don't chase that monkey.
That's right, listeners. Diana is saying just do it once and you're good.
All right.
But yeah, I was like, I feel great. This is fucking awesome. I'm going to surgery now. Bye. And then after that, I was in so much pain that them giving me stuff, I just got back to normal, which tells you how bad things were for me at the moment. Yeah,
they made
I was in pain.
Big to do. They released River Phoenix's final film a few years ago.
Dark Blood in 2012. So they'd filmed it in 1993 and they just put it on ice for almost two decades.
Wow. All right.
Holy shit. Was he also, I think he was supposed to start Dead Man, and I think Johnny Depp stepped in for him. Because they were bros. Yeah.
Final thing, he was also going to star as Andy Warhol in a movie by Gus Van Sant.
Interesting.
All right.
I could see it.
I don't want to see it, but I did.
I miss that guy. You're right, JR. When I think of like people that felt close to being my contemporary dying, this is kind of the first one. It made me mad. Also, Running on Empty. I haven't even mentioned Running on Empty. Mm. What a fucking good movie that is. And it makes me mad we didn't get more.
And to throw in, he was great in Sneakers. We already talked about that on the show. And, you know, that was an adult role. You could really see him doing a lot of things. But, yeah, we were denied 30 years of experiences of watching him. He was denied 30 years of experiencing life. You know, he'd be a middle-aged guy right now. Mm-hmm. Completely different person between 23 and 53. Fuck yeah. Those are two different people. God. And he never got to be that older person.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Okay, well, let's move on to the movies of 1993, because we have a big in here. Not the first up, Viggo Mortensen, Liam Neeson, and Andy McDowell in Ruby Cairo.
Yeah, this is one of these where it's like, I haven't heard of this. It mostly got released overseas, but it sounds kind of interesting, except the reviews weren't great. It's like Andy McDowell, her husband Viggo Mortensen. Remember, 1993, nobody knows who Viggo Mortensen is.
Yeah.
But that's like her husband who has disappeared and is presumed dead, and he left all these like clues behind. It turns out, he's actually got like a bunch of money hidden, and I got to try to figure out what it is. And it turns out he was actually like scamming guys who were importing chemical weapons, and like Liam Neeson works for the UN, and then they fall in love. This sounds weird. I don't care. Honestly, there are much bigger fish to fry this week.
Oh, balls. We have to talk. I had a whole thing prepared. We're talking about this movie.
That's when
it came out. Starring no one. Melinda Clark and J. Trevor Edmund. Return of the Living Dead 3, which I haven't revisited in a long time, because here's the thing.
Why would you? There's so many other Living Dead things that are better.
All of my friends know to revere Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead. They're Amero classics. Very few of my friends like, dude, let's just throw on this movie. Return of the Living Dead, that movie gets thrown on almost everywhere I go, from Cap City to friends' homes. I've enjoyed that movie almost twice a year for like the last 15, 20 years.
It's so dark.
Return
of the Living Dead 1, because you have all... I watched it for the first time in prep for this.
It's so funny.
And it's fun. It's great. It's incredibly gory. But you have all these characters, spoilers, listeners, all these characters doing all these things. And it's leading up to them all instantly dying in a firebomb. So all these characters are like mid-pose and they all just vaporize.
Seeing it's written and directed by Dan O'Bannon, so that tracks. He also wrote the Alien.
Yeah, so it's produced by Dark Star. Tom Russo. I just love that story. He made Night of the Living Dead with George Romero. They had a falling out, and they split the name. You can have Of the Dead, and I'll take Living Dead. So Return of the Living Dead made a lot more movies than Romero would, including two in 2005. But I thought this was the last one up until this show. And this is maligned. But in terms of a time capsule, holy shit, is it 90s as fuck? I'd say it's racist, but it clearly is like, we're acknowledging we're in LA. We need some people of color here. So let's diversify the cast. To what end? That is up for you to decide. But really, emo's up. And like, what do you like? Goth girls the hell out of the Return of the, it's not funny at all. It is deadly serious. A guy brings back his wrong side of the tracks alt rock girlfriend from the dead with the gas from Return of the Living Dead, and it's awesome. She's naked and covered in spikes and murdering people.
Because the only way she can hold off the hunger is to cause herself pain.
Yep.
So as a zombie dead body, she starts putting spikes. And yes, she's a cutter. She is a full-on cutter. And this was baby JR's probably first experience to like the BDSM world. Because this is like definitely trying to titillate you with violence. And my baby brain had not really been like, sex and violence go together. That was not in the wheelhouse of 1993 JR, but I like rented this at the Blockbuster and I was like, huh.
Nudity and horror go together. And that wonderful naked undead scene in Return of the Living Dead, which again, that's the movie you should watch this weekend.
Oh,
if you have not.
I do not recommend Return of the Living Dead 3. I absolutely recommend Return of the Living Dead 1. The guy on this is such a dumbass.
What a wiener.
And is just, and like, it is so stupid. I mean, he's sneaking into the army base like it's sneaking into an Arby's.
Yeah.
Okay. It is just like ridiculous.
They wave him in. Oh, yeah. You're the guy's son? Yeah. Bring your girlfriend. Yeah. Come on into this secret army base.
And his girlfriend is dead, and he deadlifts a dead body all throughout this army base. Now, I have had a friend get passed out drunk at a bar one time. That has happened to me one time in my life. And me and two other dudes were like struggling to get his ass down two flights of stairs. I cannot imagine lifting one dead body throughout an army base by myself.
I could do it. I could do it. I've been lifting all day, man. But Return of the Living Dead 3, I think it's the last. Like, even Dan O'Bannon and Russo had long abandoned the series at this point. I just can't believe there are two more. Both in 2005. That's how much face they have in this franchise.
This knew what it was going after, because the whole film, the entire movie, is building up to the reveal shot of BDSM zombie chick. Like, that is the entire thrust of the movie.
And nude zombie from the first film, I'm like, she is going to have a hoister for her breasts and her nipples are going to be out the whole time. It is wild exploitation, and it does. I feel like I got to say it should be seen.
Well, look up the cover and then imagine yourself as a 15-year-old boy in 1993.
This better not awaken anything in me. Okay, moving on to movie.
Something else for women.
Something else for the ladies. Got Lisa Liu. France Nguyen, Sai Chin, Qiu Chen, Tamlin Tomita, Lauren Tom, Rosalind Chow, Ming-Na Wen. Hey, I've heard her. The Joy Luck Club. The Joy Luck Club is out this week.
Joy Luck Club.
Wow, counter-programming to the max.
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah. So I'm kind of shocked to see there are four movies from 1993 that are now in the National Film Registry, and this is one of them. This was the lowest grossing one by far. It's an adaptation of the popular book by Amy Tan. It's a nice San Francisco film. Yay. And it's about four women who are Chinese immigrants and the relationship with their American born daughters. And it's very good. Like, it is very good. It's very earnest, and it's really good at pushing buttons. It did take some criticism in that, like, all men are trash in this movie. especially Asian men.
Oh.
Yeah. And people's experience that we see, like, in China is almost all, like, do we hate China in this movie too? But it is, you know, it's co-written by Amy Tan, who's Chinese. It's actually directed by a Chinese guy, which in 1993 was really fucking rare.
It's an expensive film. It's $30 million. So I was, I thought, is this financed by China? How did this get made?
You got to keep in mind, in 1993, the majority of Chinese Americans had escaped communist China. Mm-hmm. They did not have good, and that wasn't the modern Chinese communism where it's like, yeah, we're communism, but not really, and we're growing rich as fast as they can. It was the full-on communist China. Mao killed 60 million people at least. I mean, it's okay to have a negative view of that.
Yeah. So, yeah, and these are all stories of people escaping, like, after World War II. So either during the Civil War where the communists take over or during the early days of communism. And it gets to so many things. Like, first of all, it gets to the idea of, like, you don't know who your parents were when they were young and what they went through. Mm. And that's a huge one. But it also really, really gets to this mother-daughter thing that I, like, never see shown, which is, like, daughters always think their mothers are criticizing them, and mothers are always criticizing their daughters in ways that is not actually criticism. Like, it's a very particular sort of, like, passive aggressive kind of, like, backhanded compliment thing that mothers and daughters often have, where it's like, I can't believe you said that. And it's like, I said you look nice. And it's like, everyone takes everything the wrong way. And it, like, gets to that really well, while also talking about, you know, immigrant parents and the kind of the idea, like, the tiger mother, the idea that, like, Chinese and Asian parents push their kids really, really hard, and then the kids succeed and they are resentful, or they don't succeed and they're resentful. And man, does it cover a lot of ground for a movie. It's, you know, just over 2 hours, and it's got some flaws, but overall, like, I want to see more movies like this where there is so much emotional complexity going on.
How many movies do we get about Asian American women?
I actually have a stat on this. For modern day depictions of Asians, this is the first one in 30 years from Hollywood.
Wow.
Jesus.
And then the next one was Crazy Rich Asians.
That's can't be.
Yeah, like every 30 years we would get modern set movie starring Asian Americans.
No. What the Better Luck Tomorrow, and
that's not a Hollywood movie.
Oh, it's not?
No, it was an independent movie.
Okay. Okay.
This is from Hollywood Pictures. This is a Disney movie.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
They got in a bidding war over the book. And somehow they ended up with it, with Oliver Stone producing. He somehow ended up with the rights.
Well, I thought they nailed it. And I thought in a lot of ways it's timeless and across cultures, because a lot of hyphenated Americans have mixed feelings about the home countries. One minute you regard it with romanticism, and the next minute you can regard it as bumfuck Hicksville that you're so glad you're out of there. You know, those two feelings are often in conflicting with each other, and this film captures that perfectly.
Mm-hmm. I was expecting something a lot sappier than what I got. I don't know why. Just, I guess its reputation is a chick flick because it stars so many women and it's about women's stories. And still, I want more of this sort of, like, emotional resonance while also dealing with all these larger generational issues. So it's really good.
It's an adult-ass movie. Highly recommend
it. I can relate to it. I'm not Chinese, and I am not the daughter of immigrants. And still, I was like, well, shit. Yeah, I understand how you feel that way. Yeah. Oh, my God. She had to do what? Yeah.
My wife is the daughter of immigrants, not Chinese ones, but Jewish ones. And we watched it together, and at the end of it, I just told her, you know, I always want to fill her life with light and love, because this is a touching movie, and you see it, and your heart just really feels.
The poster is a hug. That's why I've never seen it. It's like, is this tragic or weepy? I don't know.
Both.
I knew Diana had mentioned she was going to talk about this. But I couldn't find it at the last minute. The next film,
you weren't watching enough Comedy Central in the mid 90s.
Yeah, I missed this entirely. I missed this entirely. Kate Nelligan, Sean Young, Sherilyn Fenn, and the clip, James Remar, and Armand Asante in Fatal Instinct. What, like, you heard me praise Loaded Weapon 1 because it was like, oh, I have a much better knowledge of the action movies of the late 80s, early 90s. Loaded Weapon, while, you know, has some groaners, it's really cool to see a not timeless genre parody of the time. You could never do this now. Fatal Instinct is a erotic thriller parody. Here's a bit of the trailer.
Cops don't come tougher than Ned Ravine.
Police emergency, I need the vehicle. Help me, I'm falling!
But Ned has a soft spot. Women. And falling for this woman could be fatal. Fatal Instinct.
Hey, you guys watch your step in here. There's a lot of blood.
Rated PG-13.
Yeah, I think this probably... this didn't find an audience because you got to know a lot about erotic thrillers.
Yeah, no, but this is perfectly timed. It was a tough call also which trailer to pull, because that one, you can tell it's very visual. There's a lot of visual gags. But the other one is a parody of the Basic Instinct interrogation scene starring pretty good lookalikes. And where just we're seeing from behind the not Sharon Stone, where her legs are just going all up in all crazy places, just crazy legs.
But I was more.
Yeah, but this is the perfect time because they didn't realize it at the time. But Basic Instinct, I think, is the cap on, it's the top of the mountain. Yeah. Mm-hmm. For erotic thrillers. And it's kind of all downhill from here.
Theatrically, less popular. That once straight to video and HBO could start making their own movies, they took this genre and ran it into the ground, and then internet pornography. Yeah. And we don't have them anymore.
Yeah. I still want Michael Douglas to come back as like the Clint Eastwood character in Unforgiven for one last erotic,
one last
thriller.
Lay, one last walk through VR.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, they're parodying a lot of stuff. Body Heat is kind of the main framework for this, but also there's, Basic Instinct and Double Indemnity. And this is the second to last film directed by Carl Reiner.
Carl Reiner is the director. And I kept like, does he have anything to say about this film? And I could find nothing.
No.
One of the most influential guys in comedy, up to and including making Rob Reiner, but slumming it with this movie. But what I wanted to give it credit for is, like Naked Gun, the fantastic decision of casting serious actors. Don't put comedians in this. Armand Asante is a heavy. James Remar is like great casting, in my opinion. Great casting. And I saw some clips on YouTube, but I couldn't find the film before the show. So
yeah, my big problem with it is like it has some good jokes in it, but the good jokes are really outweighed by the bad jokes. But little fun ones like, you know, Sean Young, I think it was, showing up in audience. Doing the, again, the Basic Instinct, like, I'm not wearing any underwear. And he has like a Kleenex box of underwear on his on his desk. He can just hand them to her. Okay, that is a really, really dumb joke, and I love it.
And I gotta say, Sean Young is so gorgeous in this film. Oh. And she has such a star quality that, other than her going batshit insane, I don't get why her like acting career collapsed so much that she's gonna be an Ace Ventura next year.
I think she burned some bridges, or she made herself look like a liability.
Yeah.
And
I know it's a shame. I think she's actually pretty funny in this.
Yeah, she's got good comedic timing.
Was she in one of the movies that they're parodying? It feels like she was. Or am I just confusing it with
A Kiss Before Dying? Nice. I don't think they're parodying that, but that kind of is an erotic thriller, so.
Yeah, it seems like she would be perfectly suited for something like that. Anyway, moving on to the big end.
Someone remake this. Someone make a better parody of erotic thrillers with the 30 years of hindsight. Come on.
And
you can just listen to the most recent season of You Must Remember This and just put in every single movie they talk about. They make a very good argument that Eyes Wide Shut is the last erotic thriller.
Mm. Sarah's favorite Christmas movie. Moving on to another Christmas movie. I'm going to just go ahead and throw in Paul Rubens in here, just because I had no idea how much Tim Burton had collaborated with Paul Rubens after Pee-wee's Big Adventure. They kind of did stuff fairly frequently. I didn't recognize him in Batman Returns, and I didn't recognize him in this movie, along with Glenn Shaddix. Beetlejuice.
Otho.
William Hickey, Catherine O'Hara, and Danny Elfman doing a lot of heavy lifting here. And Chris Sarandon. It's number one at the box office, The Nightmare Before Christmas.
From Touchstone Pictures. 'Twas the night before Christmas, but in the land of Halloween, it was decided that this year something new would be seen.
Surprised, aren't you?
From Tim Burton, the director of Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands, comes a motion picture experience unlike any other. Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas.
And what did Santa bring you, honey?
Rated PG. Coming this month.
I can't believe that gag is in the commercial.
Oh, I mean, there's a lot.
Santa brought me a disembodied head.
There's a lot
clearly
of
clearly dead and rotting.
A lot of stuff I can't believe made it into this movie, and I kind of get confused where Tim Burton's involvement begins and ends. But at the very least, getting this out, like, this is a very un-Disney film, and I'm pretty surprised they release it. If it weren't for Tim Burton's name, I'm not sure it would have come to unchanged.
They were so desperate to get in the Burton business, though, because they let him go.
They let him go.
They saw him make maybe $1 billion for Warner Brothers at this point.
Yeah.
Beetlejuice,
two
Batman,
original ideas, one franchise. Like, this guy can do everything. And they if you've seen how much they've made with Tim Burton, you can make fun of those Alice movies, but those are $1 billion movies. Pretty incredible.
Yep. So I didn't hear a couple names in that ad. I didn't hear Michael McDowell or Caroline Thompson, who previously wrote Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands.
Nor did you
hear
the
name. And I sure as fuck did I not hear Henry Selick.
And I
there's a great audio of Henry Selick going, and I'm Henry Selick, director of Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Because Henry Selick is an incredible filmmaker, and this is his start.
Can I do
but he doesn't get credit. Everyone thinks Tim Burton.
So a light plug. I know you all have Netflix. If you didn't see Wendell and Wild last year, because I didn't, fantastic stop motion movie by Henry Selick. It's all Halloween, Key and Peele, the story of a ghost trying to save a town from white people gentrification. It's fucking awesome. And equally, I cannot believe this exists and someone financed this because it looks amazing. And it's all Halloween. Because I watch this like every couple years and it just never, I can't. And I love Tim Burton and I loved stop motion. What I didn't love a lot then is musicals. And I didn't. I remember when I got satellite radio, because, you know, I was a very bored Chinese food delivery boy. They had the Cinemagic channel, and someone did like a 2-hour. It was the longest I ever heard Danny Elfman talk. And he started talking about, like, what is it, Cole Porter? What style is he sending up, Diana?
In which part? Like the Oogie Boogie song?
I don't know. He's doing a bunch of old musicals, which
it's Super Cab Calloway.
To me,
that's why I love it.
To me, Red, why is this like this? This movie is like 80% songs and pretty dull and not a lot happens. That's how I felt as a kid.
The songs are tough because most of the songs are not standard style musical songs. They're more like operetta songs.
They're old. He said he didn't want
to say that. This is not a musical. This is an operetta.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not, you know, verse, chorus, bridge, chorus. They sort of have sub themes and they kind of go here and then they go over here and then they go over here. Yeah.
But what's also incredible.
No big chorus-y thing. Even the most standard style songs aren't really that same way.
And I'm gonna get crucified for this. I don't think the songs are that great.
Me neither. Never at the time I thought they were uninspired, but listening to that podcast that put in the musical numbers he was inspired by, it is very authentic to what he set out to make. I'm 12 years old. I don't understand what this is, that you're celebrating something from the 1930s. Mm-hmm. I'm not getting any of that. I'm like, when are they going to do something? There's been so much music in this, and it is a beautiful.
I take it back. There are three songs I think are really solid. What's This, which has a wonderful melody. It doesn't even need to be a song. It just sounds like a piece of score that he wrote. Oogie Boogie Song is my favorite.
Yeah,
because I love the villain song and I love me Cab Calloway. Jack's Lament is also, it's just very, very pretty, but it takes like twice the length of the song to lead into the pretty part.
It's a very,
again, It's not a standard style song.
I think if I had more affection for the music, and I still do not, I would. I appreciate this movie like more than I can even express, but I don't like it very much.
This is the worst amazing movie I can talk about.
Wow.
Okay. It is.
I'm kind of there. I'm kind of there too, man.
Okay.
Let's talk about, you know, plot, character.
Yeah.
Let's go over Jack's character arc. He starts out top of the world, feeling vaguely dissatisfied. No real reason. Okay. He's dissatisfied with something. So he decides to try a new job where he fucks up everything without anyone's consent. And then he says, I did it wrong, but fuck you for telling me I screwed up. I'm awesome.
It is
there. That's his arc. That's where he starts. That's where he goes. That's where he ends. That's not an arc. That's not a human being. That is not a skeleton king. That is what is that?
It is hard to describe the movie's plot in that, like, Jack wants to do a thing. He can't.
Oh, in 1993, my father talked to me after I'd seen this movie, and I was like, well, the plot is kind of complex. And he was like, I'm sure I can understand the plot. Okay, Dad. And this is me as a snooty little teenager. So Jack is the pumpkin king, and he goes along, and he wants to steal Christmas. So then he goes and steals Christmas, and they find out that there's plots against him. But he overcomes them by making sure that he makes Christmas, and he makes all the Christmas time into ghosts and goblins, and people don't quite understand. And then they shoot him down, and then a monster named Oogie Boogie tries to eat him, but then Santa comes around, and he saves everything. And then Jack says, okay, I'm fine now.
It is a big, long Tool music video with songs I don't like.
No, but
because everything amazing about this film is not the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
It's
argue Jack has a redemption arc and that he realizes his mistake. He goes and rescues Santa, and Santa sort of is like, I understand your heart was in the right place. Put that passion into what you're good at.
Really? I thought Santa was kind of like a dick. I mean, understandably, because
he's a little
bit, kidnapped, but he was like, of course I can fix this, bitch. I'm Santa Claus.
Yeah.
He always...
This is true. Now, yeah, if you want to get beyond the music or the plot, the effects of this, this was nominated for Best Visual Effects at the Oscars.
As it should have been.
Because there was no animated feature category yet. And I thought that was very interesting that they would consider this. Yes, this is made up of visual effects. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's going to get stopped by Jurassic Park. It probably would have won except for Jurassic Park, yeah.
I was going to say, if it wasn't for Jurassic, it absolutely should have won. Because the scene where the hill unfurls itself, that is so beautiful. That is a thing of beauty, and I am glad it is in this world. So, yes,
How is he standing on there with his tiny stick legs? How is that not falling over?
A whole bunch of people got super high and spent 12 hours moving little figures little bit. Now, I'm half joking there, but I've read documentaries, and it's like a lot of people on the spectrum find doing stop motion to be very relaxing. So they just get in the zone, often while on pot, for hours and hours and find it to be a soothing meditative practice, which I can totally see.
Really fun. Some of the effects to make Jack in the movie, have you seen the character Jack? I think he was there last year, but for Disney World's Halloween celebration. Have you seen that Jack? Yeah.
They've been folding Nightmare Before Christmas since like 2001 or so, and starting with Disney Parks, little bits at a time, reskinning Haunted Mansion, stuff like that.
In land. No, they made like, it is like a 10, 12 foot tall Jack Skellington with four or five people dressed in black operating rods behind him.
Oh.
So if you have not seen this thing, Google it. It looks amazing. And because I love Jack's design. I love Zero's design. I love Finkelstein, Oogie Boogie. I love it all. I just, the movie doesn't come together into something I can enjoy on a regular basis.
The designs are amazing, and that's why this is a cultural juggernaut to this day. When I see it referenced, it's always the design. It's not the plot. It's not even the characters, except for the character's design, because this is filling such an incredible niche for people.
Yeah.
Okay. Keep in mind, this film is seasonal 3 months out of the year.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's a huge block.
They reskin Haunted Mansion in Disneyland, I think, at the end of September through the end of December because it works.
I've always wanted to see that.
It's great.
It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, and I mean, if you want to throw down now, whether this is a Halloween movie or a Christmas movie, I guess technically it starts after Halloween. They've successfully done Halloween.
They are in the midst of Halloween. So I will say that this is a Halloween movie.
How many Christmas movies
do we have? Why do the Christmas people have to steal this one Halloween movie?
I'm not trying to. I want it to be more Halloween. Instead, your main character behaves like a villain and Santa has to come in and fix everything like the hero. That's a Christmas movie.
Because our main character is a villain. He is a bad human being, if you want to just call him a human. He's a bad person.
You could name this in a different territory, Santa Saves Christmas, and it'd be the same fucking movie.
All right, now I have a question for you guys. We see there are other doors to other holiday lands. Now, it is a very America-centric holiday things. Mm-hmm. We see Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving, Independence Day, Valentine's Day, and St. Patrick's Day.
Can you imagine
which do you want to go to?
Okay, I was going to say, I bet St. Patrick's Day is incredibly offensive. Okay. It's got to be just a bunch of drunken Irish people all over the place.
It's just everything is just the fighting Irish.
What
logo.
The fuck is this? What the fuck is this? Who the fuck is this guy now?
What's this? Go fuck your fucking mom.
What's this? It's a headbutt. Bah! I never said this. I love Easter. Without the whole Jesus thing. If you can get rid of, like, and Christmas managed to do that.
Well, Christmasland doesn't have any Jesus in it.
I know, but
so
it's a little hard.
Easterland doesn't have any
Jesus. It feels
Jesus
harder,
in it.
Yeah. But bunnies, you know, and marshmallows and jelly beans, like, hell yeah.
I feel like I would get sick of the Christmas aesthetic, but I feel like I could handle the Thanksgiving aesthetic for the longest amount of time because it's just pleasant fall, warm.
Pumpkin spice lattes, an antique truck with a big pumpkin in the back.
That's exactly. I am Thanksgiving land 24/7. I want to go sledding on a mountain of cranberries.
I'm telling you,
cornbread stuffing.
Thanksgiving land. Just looks like every
mashed potato slopes.
Thanksgiving land looks like the opening of every Hallmark movie. I'm telling you, it's got Candace Cameron in there every time.
That's fine. We'll talk about something else. Also, I want the other holidays though. Like I said, this is it's American Christmas too. There's no Father Noel here or anything like that. It's like, where are the I want to go to Nauru's land. I want to go to Holi. I want some international holidays up in this bitch.
Fair.
Although I want to go to Hanukkah Town as depicted on The Critic.
I mean, you could absolutely make this a horror movie where you go into Christmas land and it's just Krampus.
I'm mainly astounded by at this point, as Tim Burton is on the verge of making a Beetlejuice sequel. Everybody has shown restraint in not doing anything else with this. Like, it is
because
merchandise out the ass.
Yeah.
Stop motion takes forever. Yeah. Like, forever. This was like a 5+ year endeavor.
Yeah, but it's a machine now. They can do it a little faster at this point. There's a lot of green screen involved in modern stop motion.
I guess they're I'm sure they're pitching it. Why don't we just do it all on computers? And no, that will ruin the specialness of this film. I mean,
I don't want them to. I'm just astounded they have not. Like everything else Disney has done one or two other things with and not this.
I believe there's a video game that continues.
There is. It's one of the only Disney movies to get its own video game years after the movie's release. I can't think of that ever happening again.
I think this is like one of the slowest burns of all time. It amazes me. Like, it did very well in theaters.
Yeah.
Yeah. It made $50 million, which isn't amazing, but it's not bad.
But
either.
It's been theatrical released in America several more times.
Several times. It grew on, you know, I think ABC would run it sometimes around Halloween. It grew on VHS and then DVD and then streaming. And then that merchandise. First it starts at Hot Topic and it was like half of what Hot Topic had. Mm-hmm. And just slowly creeping out like it's at my Walgreens right now. It's because they found a way to market Halloween with copyrighted characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Appreciate this movie. I can't love this movie. I can't.
I do want to say I think it... threw too big of a shadow over the field of stop motion. Because like every stop motion film after this had to be a little bit creepy or a lot creepy. It's like, that's it. That's all you can do with stop motion.
I want to say that's just like his wheelhouse, and there's not a lot of other people doing it. You don't find that in like Aardman stuff. Their style is completely different. But we don't have a lot of people in this field, and I wish there were more. I really do. But JR reminds me a lot of how we felt about Dark Crystal. Like, I'll buy the merchandise. I love this world. This just isn't that pleasant of a film.
As a narrative journey, it's much lesser than it is as a visual journey.
Oh, and I did have the luxury. I watched Wind When Wild for the first time a couple weeks ago. You can see there have been an incredible progression in stop motion animation. For the most part, this movie will look great forever because effort. You like, even little kids understand how this was made and know that it's hard and how like it still has. How the fuck did they do that? How did they do that?
Yeah.
And but you can see how much the field has progressed, which I'd never really thought about with stop motion. I think about it a lot with animation. I just don't know why we don't talk about it with stop motion. So I just had that odd luxury of seeing two of Henry Selick's movies set around the holidays within a couple weeks of each other. And it doesn't look antiquated. You can just see what they hide better in new movies.
Let me pose this question.
Please.
Is Oogie Boogie the only serial killer in Disney villain history? Because you think about the other villains, you know, Sultan wants to rule the land, Gaston just wants to be a hero. Oogie Boogie just wants to straight up murder people other reason than murdering them.
Ursula has trapped these souls, but she hasn't killed them. She hasn't murdered them. So not all, but again, are these people?
Well, they're beings.
Right.
Are they alive?
I
mean, Zero's not, but he's conscious, so he deserves respect.
It's they don't seem in Halloween Town to be like actually killing people because it's Halloween. It's not horror theme world. This is the child version of Halloween where you play a spooky killer, but it's all in fun. And so I think all their scares in Halloween Town are all in fun, except for Oogie Boogie, who is straight up murdering the citizens of Halloween Town and this big fat man who he knows nothing about, but he's like, well, no new person to kill.
I love thinking about the Disney executives as they're watching this and going, because this was going to be released under the Disney banner, and they must have gotten about 10 seconds in and were like, fuck no, this is Touchstone. But, I mean, stuff like the clown with the tearaway face, and he's a nice guy.
It's
a scary term, the clown with the tearaway face.
They can't
That's
wait
a
to
line in a Disney film. Yes.
It's pretty nuts. I'm glad it exists. I really am.
So
final credit. I have to give this film credit. It's a Halloween movie that came out before Halloween.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Unlike today, I just watched Haunted Mansion, the new version, because it dropped on Disney Plus, and that released in August. Now, I am 100% the problem for why Disney films do not do well in theaters anymore. I always wait for them to come on Disney Plus. Why wouldn't I? It's a fortune to take my kids to the theaters all as a family, or I can just wait for it to be on Disney Plus. But you can't make big budget movies like Haunted Mansion for theaters and have them bomb and just throw them on Disney Plus. I don't think it. I think Disney is eating their seed corn.
It is also the first time I noticed, I watched this on Disney Plus as well, there's a merchandise tab. Like, and I don't shop a lot through my Xbox controller, but there's a right underneath the movie is a shop for items like, you better control yourself. There is way too much merchandise for Nightmare Before Christmas to start throwing it on the fucking landing page for the movie.
You know what? I think I have a very good counter argument. If I were going to make a counter argument to Chris's argument, that's like, it just doesn't grab you. Mm-hmm. This movie is short as hell.
It feels very long.
It is 76 minutes long, including credits.
My memories of it are always that it's 2.5 hours. I'm not kidding. I have always thought this was the longest animated movie ever made.
I think one of the reasons for its success is you can throw it on at a Halloween party and it's just on the background. No one has to pay particular attention to it. And it's short. It'll be over soon.
Yeah, throw on your white zombie in front of it. And I'm not a fan of the music. And part of that, I'm just going to blame on Kingdom Hearts, because that was a there was too much Nightmare Before Christmas in those first two games, and I remember getting stuck, and it is just this hours of that, and like you can blame Kingdom Hearts for my my sour pussiness, but okay, let's move on. Nightmare Before Christmas, I can't like say I don't recommend it, because it is an astounding feat of cinematic beauty. It really is.
Yep.
It's just I don't love it.
It is the worst narrative I'm going to highly recommend in all of 2010.
And it brought stop motion back into movie theaters. I think 1986 had a Gumby movie, and I'm kind of at a loss for how much stop motion we had outside of that. And now we get one like every 2 years. Now Del Toro might work in the field exclusively after Pinocchio.
I am all for it.
Me too. Me too.
I love that idea. Please do.
Oh my God, television of 1993, 30 years ago, what? October 27th through November 2nd. This is my favorite thing. How did we pinpoint a date for this? This
is just the best we could.
And
I needed to include this. So this is the best date I could
90s
find.
Kids, does this trigger any bells for you? I didn't want to say ring, I said trigger, because no one chose to watch this.
Question, it's a tough one. Who shot Alexander Hamilton in that famous duel? All right, let's go to the phones and see who's out there.
Hello?
Hello, for $10,000, who shot...
Alexander!
Excuse me?
Alexander. Hold on, let me get some milk.
I'm afraid your time is almost up.
Alexander!
I'm sorry, maybe next time.
Ellen Boo.
Oh, I said little Ellen Boo at the end. Sean Whalen is that actor's name.
Yes.
And I have to shout him out, because every time he pops up in something like People Under the Stairs or Twister, I'm like, all right.
Ellen Boo.
Poor bastard. He's never going to escape that.
Yeah. Do you think Aaron Burr had any ideas of how many ways he would be famous throughout the course of history in this milk commercial directed by Michael Bay? And when you know that, I seriously recommend going back and watching it, because it is gorgeous and moves very, very fast.
That rack focus to the bullet.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. I absolutely give him credit for it. Maybe Michael Bay should have only made 30-second movies from now on.
And the again, the creepiness of the ubiquity of milk commercials, as if, dude, we don't have an alternative. Everyone's drinking milk. It's why are you advertising this? It's in every recipe. It's in every refrigerator. I'm so happy I don't drink milk at all anymore. But there was no soy milk in 1993. Who's advertising milk and why?
I could go for a glass of milk right now.
Dude, last time I had a glass of milk, I farted and shit down my leg. My body cannot process it anymore.
Welcome to the club.
You need to be more tolerant, Chris.
Great. I am intolerant towards
another lactose. Lecture. Jesus Christ.
You can't stop. Actually, honestly, is my little money-saving tip for people. If you don't drink a lot of milk, getting the lactose-free milk, it lasts way longer.
Ever. Never have to throw it out.
That shit lasts like 6 weeks.
Hell
because
it
doesn't have the sugar in it, so it doesn't spoil as fast.
Hell yeah.
Tip for you.
And shut up, you kids. Get off my lawn. It's time to talk about Diagnosis Murder, which debuts on CBS.
I hope they put where young people belong, in jail.
A show I only watched at my grandparents'. They loved it.
Yeah, because it's a mystery procedural starring Dick Van Dyke, who's so wonderful and adorable, and we love
him.
It's still with us, knock on wood, 97 years old, and he's it's got some humor to it compared to most other crime shows.
I'd put it with that Columbo or Murder, She Wrote, in that it throws in just the right amount of humor and a tiny bit of romance in most episodes. So
yeah, Yeah, and probably a guest star or two you remember from some show from 80 years ago. You know,
it's like very time. Technically a Jake and the Fat Man spinoff, but it all there's a Diagnosis Murder universe because I don't. It spins off into other shows. I believe they use it as a launching pad for several short lived, and I think a couple decently alive shows. I can't remember, but Diagnosis Murder. Mm-hmm. Sorry, we're not the show to talk about this. We were not watching it.
8 years, though. That's a long time.
8 years is respectable. Again, 30 years ago, Dick Van Dyke playing an elderly man. South of Sunset also debuts on CBS. I'm assuming that's for old people, too.
Former chief of security for a motion picture studio sets up a private eye shop in the bad area of Beverly Hills.
And the...
Starring Glenn Frey of the band The Eagles.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
The heat is on CBS.
Oh, on ABC, we have the debut of the Paula Poundstone show. I never think this, but I feel like I have. Where's her show? She's like one of the most recognized stand-up comedians in the universe. Here it was 30 years ago, short-lived.
Hi, it's me, Paula Poundstone, with a brief history of the world and television. The Black Plague, the American Revolution, television. Here we have Starsky and Hutch, or the dawning of Huggy Bear, and... The Paula Poundstone Show. It's got to be more pleasant than the Black Plague.
The Paula Poundstone Show premieres Saturday on ABC.
All right, Paula Poundstone. I'm going to just take this a little out, just so we don't talk about it as much as we did last week. Mystery Science Theater, The Brain That Wouldn't Die, Mike's first episode. Only The Office did like changed out its its figureheads in the middle of a season like this. I can't think of many other shows that... would do something that's risky, but to me, it doesn't miss a beat. It's hilarious. Mike proves himself to be a great substitute for Joel.
I mean, he comes out of the gate running. He established himself as a different character than Joel right out the gate because Dr. Forrester is calling and Mike just makes him wait and the bots are getting super nervous and it's just suddenly, okay, this isn't sleepy-eyed Joel, this is a different character. And
I never understood the Joel versus Mike people because it's such a different dynamic. You go from parent to the... Now Mike's the new guy being tormented by the robots. It's a different flavor. They're not the same. It's just awesome. They can coexist. But great, and a great movie, too. The Brain That Wouldn't Die. Very iconic for cheesy sci-fi
Jan
fans.
Pan.
Jan the Pan. And then... let's get... And then TV movie... One we didn't see, Double Toil and Trouble, Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen, probably a huge success on home video, if not a ratings winner, because they were going to make
this
many
like
more
of these. Second
of
these, or they just make a little TV movie that's for dumb babies, but whatever.
Look at this cast, Keith David, Steve Buscemi, John C. McGinley, Ted Levine, Dermot Mulroney, and Mickey Rourke in a TV movie called The Outlaw. Gimme, what is this?
The Last Outlaw? It's a Western. And it's about, you know, former Confederate soldiers, and then they head west, as that often is the case. And, yeah, I'm trying to remember, it's directed by someone who's actually made, like, real... Oh, Young Guns 2. Same guy directed Young Guns 2 and a couple other things. And it sounds like it was supposed to go to theaters and, like, HBO snapped it up. But it's like, that cast is like... I just want to see them play cards together and tell stories.
And then a little bit of TV news, and it... Not for us, but it technically is earth-shattering news because, Jesus Christ, we lived in a three-network world before any of us listening were born for so long. Fox comes and upsets everything in 1986. Takes almost 10 years for the big studios to take a stab at network programming. Paramount Pictures, I think a week before Warner Brothers, announces we are getting in, we're going to pull a Fox. I'm not really sure how they did it other than maybe Clinton because... There were monopoly laws in place. These people weren't supposed to be allowed to own networks. That was the plan. They didn't want the movie studios coming in and taking over television. You can make stuff for networks you don't own, but once you own the channel, you can prioritize programming that you make and keep stuff people don't like on the air. And WB and Paramount Network would have no other choice. Lots of long-lived programming, little watch, but long-lived programming. They don't come out, I think, for another year or so. But, man, you have to remember that marketing blitz. That was pretty odd. Michigan J. Frog.
The WB's research into, okay, who's the most recognizable Warner Brothers cartoon character that's not like a major character. And finding out Michigan J. Frog, even though we didn't know his name, who was in what, three cartoons?
Two.
Had like insane recognition because those are great fucking cartoons.
One Froggy Evening is one of the best cartoons of all time. It's very, very good.
And so they're like, okay, well, I guess that's our mascot. And the poor secretaries at the company had to actually answer the phone, WWWB, how can I help you?
Oh, and Paramount had a little card up its sleeve, SmackDown. No, but it did. Like, I remember we didn't have Paramount Network. We had a TV channel that would air 1 hour of programming a week because of SmackDown and Star Trek. It had Star Trek up its sleeve. Anyway, speaking of animation, quite possibly one of my favorite things of one of my favorite things, Simpsons Treehouse of Horror 4. It's the first one I watched this year because it might be my favorite.
It might be the best one. Yep. I'm sorry.
At the very least, I think this is the best animated episode of any of them, because this is when they've got the lavish animation budget and no cutbacks, and you can really just see the animators are going all out on everything.
They said they tortured themselves making Treehouse of Horror. You got three different writers, three stories that need to be compacted into like 6 minutes. And wraparounds. And I believe Conan O'Brien is responsible for the, I did not get at the time, I just lost it. Not Twilight Zone, Night Gallery. The Night Gallery wraparounds.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Because they've already parodied Franken. Here's the thing I wanted to ask you, though. When did you realize, associate Treehouse of Horror as an annual tradition?
I think it was right around here. It was either this year when I was like, okay, they're just going to keep on coming up with these, because it was like three. That's cool. The trilogy. But once you go past four, it's like, well, now I'm going to assume you're going to do this every year until the point when the show becomes unprofitable.
Well, to me, it was this episode, partially because I don't think I had a ton of awareness of what they were parodying at the time. I'd seen some of these Twilight Zone episodes, but I had seen Bram Stoker's Dracula. And that's very heavily, his hairdo was so queer. It was the boy. I love every.
Kill my boss. Do I dare to live the American dream?
Dad, that's his crutch.
come on in. Yes. Fresh victims for my ever growing army of the undead. Sir, you have to let go of the button. Oh, son of a.
It was the ending with the outright Peanuts reference that in my head, like, oh. We're going to do this every fucking year. And for some reason after this, this is when I remember people starting to talk about Treehouse of Horror as a thing. Like, because somehow didn't occur to us this was going to happen every year. They were new every year. You tune in every week hoping for a new episode of The Simpsons. And sometimes you get it and sometimes you don't.
I remember the first one and how, like, huge a thing that was to all the kids. Like, it was.
My dad still quotes it.
Awesome. So awesome. And then, but we just thought that was just a one-off.
Yeah.
They're not going to do that every single year. And then when they did it again, oh my God, I was so happy, but it wasn't as good. And like, but then, once they get to the third one, it's like, oh, we really are doing this every year. And we're just doing funny versions of stories I already know.
Yeah.
So this one has Devil and Homer Simpson, Terror at 5.5 feet, and Bart Simpson's Dracula. Mwah! Chef's kiss.
Introduction of Uter.
Is it really?
Whoa.
Yes. Wow. This is the first time we get Uter, and I guess you could say we've all got a little Uter inside of us.
Yeah. I love knowing that Wang Computers, Martin's shirt, that's a real company. Good joke. Even more solid joke.
I will never forget for as long as I live because, I'm from Philly. And when they bring in Devil and Homer Simpson, the Jury of the Damned, as I mentioned, with Lizzie Borden and John Wilkes Booth, and the starting lineup of the 1976 Philadelphia Flyers. My dad laughed so hard, the hardest I have ever had. And my dad has a big laugh already. And it was like we missed the next 3 minutes. He was just dying because the 76 Flyers were notoriously violent. One time, I think they teamed up with the cops to beat up the Rangers before they even made it to the ice.
And I love the datedness of the, but I'm not dead yet. Oh my God. Months, Mr. Nixon. And then 30 years, kids will have to ask their parents, is that guy still around? No. They made one joke 30 years ago. Confused everybody for the end of time. I love that. Yeah. Conan O'Brien is credited as Watch Conan O'Brien. I think I'd seen the Twilight Zone movie, but I would have like seen it once. I don't know that I had seen the I probably saw the episode because, but yeah, it was Twilight Zone was just like, I didn't love it until I like didn't have it because it was always on TV. But this was just, this is when I realized
there's a gremlin on the side of the bus. that joke you have to explain to kids now, that there's a car called a gremlin.
My mother took my keys away. She was right to do it. everything. This is one of my favorites of all time. And it's like, I don't know, something clicked in me and like, I love this. This is my favorite thing. I'll look forward to this every year. And I was talking to someone about like, I haven't gotten a tattoo for so long. I forgot to want one. And then we were talking about like, maybe I should want to get such a fucking hard decision. And I'm like, Santa's Little Helper dressing like Snoopy at the end of Treehouse of Horror. It's one of my favorite gags in the history of the show, that just to pull out and see that. That might be
a little dance.
Yeah. Aww. Very recognizable dance the dog is doing. Anyway, television. How's that for a fucking exciting week? Mike Nelson's debut and Jesus Christ, Treehouse of Horror. Oh, and all these fucking games now. Daffy Duck.
So this is the start of Christmas season. Listeners, if you wanted your video games to be available for children to buy in Christmas, you pretty much had to release them late October, early November, in the hopes that they would get across the country, because we're still very much in the area of the drop date is whenever it gets off the truck that
they have to appear in those if you remember those catalogs and pamphlets. You need to have we need to have some assurance this will arrive by the time the pamphlet goes out, the mailers go out, and people know what's in stores, because there is no Amazon. So a ton of Super Nintendo games out in this period. Daffy Duck, the Marvin missions. Could have just called it Duck Dodgers, the game, but I guess that brand wasn't strong enough yet. The Incredible
Duck Dodgers were always my favorite cartoon.
Oh,
by far.
Yeah.
By far.
Yeah.
So good. Incredible Crash Test Crash Dummies, not Test Dummies, Crash Dummies. Man, that... How do you merchandise your PSA? That's something
I cannot imagine the kid who has won video game for the Christmas season is going to be a $60 game based upon a PSA.
Well, it could also be Last Action Hero once again for Super Nintendo.
You know, at the time when Last Action Hero was bombing, I was telling myself, maybe I should start collecting Last Action Hero memorabilia just so, you know, it would be something easy to collect. If I want to collect Star Wars, which I was at the time, already in 1993, it was expensive to get some of the original figures. But I was figuring, hey, I could just get all this stuff at the bargain bin at Target, and that can be my collectorthon.
I tried that with Waterworld. I still have my sealed figures to this day of no worth whatsoever. Hey, this is a big one. NHL 94.
Okay. All right. Listeners, if you haven't heard of this game, this is the game I was referencing last week. There are still regular tournaments about this 1993 Super Nintendo sports game played to this very day. It has been rated the greatest sports game of all time. And that's when it's about hockey, which, don't get me wrong, hockey's great, but it's not as popular as soccer, basketball, football, or even baseball.
Right. But the game has a legacy that, you know, we can see it in Swingers, Mallrats.
I was going to ask, what is the game that they're playing in Swingers? Because I feel like it's probably this, or
I feel like it's
the next edition of it.
I'm not entirely
sure. I mean, can you
make
Gretzky's head bleed? That's the question.
You can bleed in this game. In Swingers, they play the previous edition, but this is the one that most people really say is the superior one. This is the one that has become the most famous. And you are banned from playing one team in
Philadelphia
NHL 94 tournaments. Do you know why?
Why?
Because of JR.
What?
There is a hockey player in this game called JR who is the Bo Jackson of Tecmo Bowl of this game, and he just has stats out the wazoo, and as a result, you're banned from playing him
in
any tournament.
NHL 94, and then a big one for me, not to get all gooey on it, but like about once a year, there'd be a phenomenon that I was really into, and then video games happened, and that to get my phenomenon in my phenomenon was something that had only happened with Ninja Turtles. It only happened with The Simpsons, because this week Super Star Wars is out. It usually takes forever to get a thing you like in a decent game form. Ren and Stimpy right. Show, Vidiots.
Yep. Yeah, the merch bandwagon is just cavalcading.
Only took 2 years.
Yeah.
But it's here. It's not great. I played the shit out of it. And I think the Genesis would best it with a dedicated fart button.
And quick correction, coming out this week is not Super Star Wars. Super Star Wars, The Empire Strikes.
Sorry, yes.
This is the sequel to the original Super Star Wars. And I'm again going to defend the Super Star Wars games. I think they are fun platformers. This one improves upon the first one. You can use your lightsaber in more interesting ways. It's got some fun Mode 7 levels. It's still fun to play for me.
It's pretty ridiculous to think about it. I guess it's not that old a movie, technically. 13 years, whatever. 13 mm-hmm. years, but it's on the cover of Nintendo Power. It's like, it's crazy. It's very exciting. Can you say the same for Sim Ant? Ladies and gentlemen, Sim Ant is out this week.
So my friend played Sim Ant all the time, and he just gushed to me about how fascinating ants are because he played this game. Like, he learned all about them, and we would, like, go outside.
Is he still alive?
He's still alive.
Oh, thank God. Yeah. Not all Sim Ant players got out that easy. It's a cursed game.
But we'd watch real ants, and he'd tell me all about them, and then I tried to get into the game, and I just never could.
Sunset Riders is also out. Konami Western game. Solid, baby.
Third best Western video game of all time.
Oh, damn. Wizard of Oz, speaking of old movie properties hitting the Super Nintendo.
What the hell?
It's the monoculture. Wizard of Oz is a huge brand in 1993.
I also think there's some importance. Kids aren't able to... Most people who are into games are kids, and most kids can't buy their own games. Parents are more likely to buy something they recognize than something their kids are begging for during the holidays. So... Throw Wizard of Oz in there.
And we are right around heading into Thanksgiving time when, you know, a lot of channels would run Wizard of Oz, so it feels about right. Thanksgiving or Easter every year, yeah.
But I feel so far sorry for any kids who got this, because this regularly makes the list of worst Super Nintendo games of all time.
Arrow the Acrobat. Oh my God, I'm almost out of energy.
Dead platformer is dead. You know, there were so many attempts to capture the Mario or Sonic mania, and they're so dead these days.
The Sunsofts, wasn't it? And then The Secret of Mana for Super Nintendo, one of the best games I've never played.
This has a gigantic reputation, but it falls into the trap of not being a game I loved when I was 15. And so therefore, when I try to pick it up, I'm just like, well, okay.
I know, listeners of VGA, this is where I would go into my Trump character and talk about The Secret of MAGA and rip apart every other JRPG. I'm not going to do that. You have to listen to VGA. Anyway, music of 1993, October 27th through November 2nd. Dream Lover by Mariah Carey is still number one, but there are new albums out, such as The Red Shoes by Kate Bush, Full Moon, Dirty Hearts by INXS, The Black Rider by Tom Waits, Croonin' by Anne Murray, Jericho by The Band, Shouldn't Have Told You That by a little indie band that nobody liked called The Dixie Chicks Cowgirl All-American, just Cowgirl Band. Wow, I did not know their name was that long.
The Chicks.
The Yellow Shark by Frank Zappa and Duets by Frank Sinatra. Can you really believe all of these groups coexisted on the record shelf at the same time?
Fucking Duets album by Frank Sinatra. It sold so many copies, yep. And it is not very good. Mm. Like, the idea of Frank Sinatra singing with Luther Vandross or Aretha Franklin or Bono or Barbara Streisand, like, these are all great singers. Why does... I feel like every one of these songs, I just want one of them to shut up. just give me the regular version of the song.
Mm.
I hate them. Hate them. But, oh my God, it made so much money.
Yeah, it's on the charts for a very, very long time. Let's close out with something from Night Before Christmas. How about Oogie Boogie Song? Because of all villain songs are cool. The coolest songs.
True.
Looking at you, Aaron Burr. Hell yeah. So we'll close out with Oogie Boogie Song, but don't move. We actually have more of a show to do after this hour and change. We'll be right back. And you better pay attention now, because I'm the boogeyman. And if you aren't shaking, there's something very wrong, because this may be the last time you hear the boogie song. Whoa.
Would you like exclusive bonus podcast commentaries and more from the LaserTime crew? Then we strongly encourage you to support this show on patreon.com/lasertime. It supports not only this show, but all the rest of the LaserTime network. You'll get commentaries, play games with the hosts, see exclusive videos first, and receive an uncut weekly ad-free podcast bonus time. Speaking of which, here's a quick taste.
The 1980s were the golden age of mean hard R comedies.
I think I was remembering my sanitized commercial television viewings because, like, Beverly D'Angelo's naked for, like, no reason, and I totally forgot about that.
I had forgotten all about that because that shocked me, too. I was like, wait a minute. We see her boobies a couple of times. I don't remember that.
This might be a fact. This is the fourth National Lampoon movie? I was shocked to find that out because there's two I have never seen or heard of between Animal House.
Two that are kind of lost. One of them's called National Lampoon Goes to the Movies. And
Class
then,
Reunion.
Class Reunion. Yeah, that's right. I think this is the last movie that where it's clearly defined. Like, Harold Ramis is involved in this in some way. Like, we have some DNA of people who worked in National Lampoon magazine. Mm-hmm. And now it's just kind of like anything goes. Now it's like stoner frat comedies, but not always.
The company doesn't exist, and they sold the name to put on shitty movies that are, like, already being made, I believe. And they just, they'll affix the National Lampoon's. I guess the R is for the magazine's reputation itself. It was pretty fucking edgy for its time.
Get Bonus Time, a weekly, uncensored, and commercial-free podcast every Tuesday, starting for just $5 on patreon.com/lasertime.
Coming in with a Reptilia by the Strokes off A Room on Fire. Oh, who doesn't love this song? It's a good one. Good driving song. Welcome to 2003. 20 years ago, the meat in the 30-2010 sandwich. That can't be. that can't be at all. We talked way too much in the first and second, third segments, as I found last couple weeks. Other new music releases released 20 years ago. You got Hope by Nonprofits, Three by the Sugababes, Modern Artillery by The Living End, The Rise of Brutality by Hatebreed, The Terror State by Anti-Flag, Come Feel Me Tremble by Paul Westerberg, Everything to Everyone by Bare Naked Ladies, and Group Therapy by Dope, Baby Boy by Beyonce featuring Sean Paul is still number one. Here's some fun news from 20 years ago. If you like good musicals, suck it, Night Before Christmas. Wicked premieres on Broadway at the Gershwin Theater, starring Idina Menzel and Kristen Chenoweth. Or how did John Travolta pronounce her name?
Hadabila Adele Dazeem.
Adwagazaba.
Adele Dazeem. Wicked is still playing 7,500 plus performances later.
And the threatened big screen version has still yet to make any kind of headway.
They're supposed to be filming, and it's going to be in two parts?
Oh, no!
Oh, come on!
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, wait.
Is this the start of, like, Broadway really trying to do movies? Because this is really based more on the movie than it is the book.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Broadway's trying... But the musicals have been movies for quite a while now.
But I'm saying, is this the start?
I don't know. And also, this week, 20 years ago, the legal version of Napster's launches with song downloads for 99 cents or unlimited listening for $9.99. And I could not tell you what the interface looks like because I never engaged with Napster at all once it became not theft.
Yep. Well, they're smart to price it the same as iTunes is pricing it, 99 cents. Yeah.
$9.99 unlimited option seems bizarre, even 20 years ago. I feel like, Jesus Christ, when was that ever an option for, like, online music? I felt like that was, like, 10 years ago that started happening. Anyway, moving into the movies of 2003, October 27th through November 2nd, Scary Movie is still number one at the box office, people. But we have some other new movies out. If you like more of an immigrant tale, but with an Irish flavoring, Jimon Hounsou, did I say his name right?
Close enough.
Who? Samantha Morton, Patty Considine, In America.
Jim Sheridan joint, which he wrote with his daughters.
Yeah.
Okay. Guy who did With My Left Foot and In the Name of the Father, we're going to talk about later. This is a charmer.
Yeah.
It's a story of poor immigrants, only, you know, they're white, so maybe more people will pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what else to say. They are really fucking struggling. This, you know, family and their two daughters, and they live in fucking rat trap tenement. And it's like unclear when it takes place, like early 90s, maybe.
Yeah, 80s, 90s. Yeah, very unclear. And I still don't see that much strife for Irish people. It's just hard. 80s and 90s? We don't hire the Irish here at Discovery Zone.
You know, and yeah, their neighbor is Jimon Hounsou. He gets a fucking Oscar nomination out of this, which makes me very happy. I want that guy to have better work besides just going, who? Like, come on. He's like the ninth build guy in Guardians of the Galaxy. He's a really good actor.
He's there for like 10 seconds. He's all over one of the How to Train Your Dragons. And also this week, Blythe Danner, Lucy Davenport, Daniel Craig, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Sylvia. The Sylvia Plath story.
Don't make a Sylvia Plath. Like, you're never going to do anything of this justice. And I didn't even get around to watching it. I appreciate having Gwyneth Paltrow's real mom, Blythe Danner, there playing her mom. Okay, cool. They look alike, but they're both good actors. But
so I did watch this. And I have never read Sylvia Plath. Diana, is it a recommend for reading?
For reading? Yeah.
Light reading,
A lot of her poetry, and plus there's The Bell Jar, which is a novel, which is heavy as hell.
I really feel like it's really hard to capture poetry in film. Because other than scent, you know, I'm not sure I can picture some art form that's harder to capture in the film format, because you can have your characters read poetry, but then it's just people reading poetry. That's not really the visual medium of film. This is an exploration of mental illness. That's really what it is. And I do feel like it edges toward romanticizing the suicidal artist a little too much. You know, she's portrayed as this genius, which I'm sure she is. But, you know, a friend of mine was a bartender, and he killed himself. And I feel like you'd never make a movie about how awesome this bartender was and hint that he killed himself because he was such a genius bartender. But I feel like that can be a theme in the twisted artistic genius who kills themselves genre.
Yeah, there's just a lot to cover with her. And there are partisans, honestly. There are Sylvia partisans who really hate her husband Ted Hughes and blame him for all of her problems. And he is also a writer and a poet. He wrote The Iron Giant. There's too much for a movie. I think there's just too much there for a movie.
Probably could be a better miniseries, but
yeah.
I bet more people have seen The Iron Giant than have read all of her works combined.
Oh, I don't know. The Bell Jar is a goth teen must read.
Okay.
I don't know many other troubled teenage girls who didn't read The Bell Jar at some point, or at least started it. So,
all right. Maybe you're right.
Tough call.
Not a recommend as a movie, though. Wasn't that interesting or well done.
Well, also not recommended is...
But interesting.
I guess, yeah. Kevin Bacon, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Mark Ruffalo, and Meg Ryan in The Cut.
So this is a movie that has been reappraised.
Yeah.
I did not realize, because it is it's a kind of erotic thriller. It's especially kind of a grimy thriller, where really the big story was that Meg Ryan is trying to get rid of her America's Sweetheart vibe by being in this kind of grimy movie.
I couldn't find this streaming for free, so I went to YouTube like, oh, maybe someone put up the whole movie. I put it on in the background like years ago, back when I was stealing every movie, because Patrice O'Neill is in it. And it's not. And all these YouTube videos came up this is the movie that killed Meg Ryan's career. Like, you fucking assholes. Like, I was around. Meg Ryan's career was kind of at a downswing, and she had to try something different. This movie did not kill her career, and she's not said to be particularly bad in it, despite what you think would be miscast America's Sweetheart in this grimy sexual thriller.
Okay, but what I read was not that she did a bad performance in this. It's that she was known as this sweet, innocent love interest for Tom Hanks, and here's this actress you associate with that sweetness doing a
acting
turd
trying scene. Doing something she does the same thing in every fucking movie and had up until this one. I think she deserves a bit of credit there.
Right, that's her as an actress, and it's her as a brand. And what I saw was that this hurt the Meg Ryan brand, that America did not want
to see. The Meg Ryan brand was kind of
sweetheart
on the way out. And she was in. You can't be America's sweetheart forever. You can't be who Meg Ryan was as a woman for as long as Meg Ryan did it. Like, I'm shocked she was able to do it for 20 years almost, to be a cute leading lady. 20 years being cute? Come on. Hollywood cute? She needed to stretch her wings a little bit. And I was like, what was the last thing she did? She directed a movie with her and David Duchovny. I'm like, when is this? It's just them two. When is this coming out?
Coming out pretty soon. Yeah. But it looks like a more traditional rom-com, getting back to that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one is made by Jane Campion, who did The Piano and Power of the Dog. So, you know, it's going to get psychosexual. The whole point of it is psychosexual. At the time, a lot of people were just like, this is just grimy and grim and unpleasant. And it's sort of been reappraised by especially feminist critics as like, this is more feminist than you realize, that it is more, not necessarily empowerment, but like it is treating Meg Ryan's character not with a male gaze, but with a female gaze, even though she's dealing with like scary serial killers and being harassed and attacked by guys and
watching a blowjob on screen.
Yeah, walks by a blowjob and then that lady ends up dismembered.
I just read that it was a rubber prop, but it is in the unrated version. You can see it looks like a dick getting sucked. Holy shit. And Meg Ryan is oh my God.
Oh no.
Oh my.
Yeah. What's going to happen to her small independent bookstore?
Even more feminist. It also says Mark Ruffalo spends 20% of the film nude.
Yeah, and some of it chained up. Some fucked up shit goes on in there. I did not get around to rewatching it. I remember just sort of being like, at the time, at least, I watched it as like, this movie's trying to say something, but I can't figure out what it is. And it might be worth relooking at. It's being reappraised, I think, as people kind of look back on Jane Campion's overall career. We could talk about The Piano in a month or two.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Means Chris gets to see The Piano for the first time.
Oh, boy.
And Harvey Keitel's dick.
It's a lot of nudity. A lot of nudity.
That is the only reason I watched it. I have seen The Piano.
Not the nudity you wanted.
I liked it. I liked it. And then, you know, speaking of maybe not exactly what you wanted, I shouldn't say this movie was a huge success, despite my experience with it was I have never been in the presence of Disney removing the presence of a film in one of the parks. And I saw that happen to this film in person.
Like, this is one of the most forgotten Disney movies, animated films.
I think it is. I think it, other than, Home, you know, that range. Weird 1940s area where it's, you know.
You mean Victory Through Air Power? The
yes.
Eighth
Saludos Amigos? Yeah.
No, they have a ride in Epcot.
And they have a cartoon series. So not. True. I would say this is far more forgotten than Saludos. Yeah,
Jose and Panchito. You can still get merch. Dave Thomas, Rick Moranis, Jeremy Suarez, and the Joaquin Phoenix Disney character, which I own this. And even saying that, like, that can't be, right? Brother Bear.
Excuse me.
How's it going, Bear?
Don't call me that.
Mr. Bear?
The only thing standing in the way of him becoming a human again.
I was transformed into a bear.
Uh-huh.
Is a forest full of nuts. On November 1st.
Here, look out!
He may be headed home, but he's not out of the woods yet.
Let's get a back seat or something. I look like you hunted me.
Disney's Brother Bear, rated G, in theaters Saturday, November 1st.
No fish were harmed during the making of this film.
Oh, that's it. That's the post-credits sequence. They ruined it in this TV spot.
Yeah. but it is like the most recent Rick Moranis that we have. And Brother Bear 2.
It is notably
that Mint Mobile commercial.
No, it is Rick Moranis' last film performance. Yeah, and 20 years ago, it is also the last movie animated at MGM Studios, the East Coast animation house.
Yeah. So we've been trying for quite a while to get a recording together to talk about Strange Brew. And here we got the McKenzies.
God. And that is part of my problem with this film. Okay. I was watching like the first 15 minutes of this film, which is a serious
different
drama,
movie.
You know, a different movie entirely. You know, occasionally you see like these memes about, oh, the golden age of animated 2D action films. And you got your Treasure Planets and your Atlantises and a couple of DreamWorks films, Road to El Dorado. And it's like the medium was going in some way. And I started watching the first 15 minutes of this. And I was like, God damn, why isn't this in these memes? Because it swerves off in a completely different goofball direction. Yeah. And Disney-fies the shit out of something that was looking to be kind of interesting. For one thing, this is probably the most expensive film with nothing but Native American protagonist in all of movie history.
Yeah.
Probably, yeah. Even though not a lot of Native American representation in the cast.
No, that is something that would definitely change. I found this really interesting, especially watching it in context of like the last animated movie related to Disney we talked about is Finding Nemo, which is obviously a major achievement, visually stunning. And then this is old-fashioned animation with some digital stuff. And it reminded me a lot of Tarzan.
Yeah.
Also because it's got Phil Collins songs. Ugh. But which don't need to be there. Like Tarzan, it has non-diegetic songs where just all of a sudden there's a song over like
and none of them are good. Even Tarzan had better songs than that. Every song made this film worse.
Yep. They made Tina Turner sing a bad song for this movie.
True. Tina. It's true, but it should be noted this cost half as much as Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
But it makes half as much as Finding Nemo.
Yeah, but also, like, the animation style I found really interesting in that, like, there's a lot of animals in it. And except for the main character who's, you know, a Native American guy who gets turned into a bear to, like, learn a lesson, the way that the animals are animated, like, are closer to reality. Like, they don't look like Baloo the bear. They have, like, the prehensile lips, and they look more like bears.
Yeah, there's a lot of four-legged.
Okay, but then the tone shifts into, like, here's the wacky talking moose. Here's the wacky talking chipmunks. I guess this takes place during the Ice Age because there's mammoths, but the mammoths don't talk. So I don't know what's going on with the mammoths.
Legally, they couldn't. And Ice Age, baby. They knew it was coming.
We're past the first Ice Age, aren't we? I think we are. I think we are.
I was making a bad joke. We can move on.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but then it's like, yeah, it starts out as like a pretty solid and interesting drama. And then it gets kind of silly. And then like a little kid shows up and it's like, oh no, I could take or leave that. And then it ends like really abruptly, like the end. I learned my lesson, the end.
I'm a bear forever.
Let's talk about that ending. This is one of the best, worst, biggest Deus Ex Machina I've seen in Disney history. Because everything is resolved by the afterlife being shown objectively real.
Yes.
Okay. And there's no build up to that. It wasn't like building to this crescendo where you finally realize, ah, there is something out. It's just like moment of crisis, moment of conflict. Afterlife is real. Okay. Everything's solved.
Yeah. And they're like, oh, afterlife is real. You learned your lesson. You can stop being a bear. And he's like, can I go back to being a bear? Yes. Snap. Everyone hugs.
See you in Brother Bear 2. Which is this?
What the? That was weird that you Deus Ex Machina and then immediately did it again. Get in like 3 minutes. Like, yeah, magic seems a little too easy in this.
Yeah,
I feel like magic needs a little more of a build up.
I find this movie beautiful and wholly unremarkable. Maybe if I saw it as a kid, I feel differently. I was in my 20s and then now in my 40s, but it is fucking gorgeous. And we're kind of like the next truly the Home on the Range is probably the more forgotten Disney animated movie. And that's when they really like, we're not going to make traditionally animated films. Then they would go back on that, but they, similar to Emperor's New Groove, they comedied it up and like, let's make this more funny than lavish. So this is worth watching just in that it is incredibly lavish 2D animation, like animation porn for the most part. And that's like the best thing about the film, because like I just don't find it moving in any way at all.
I would watch the first 15 minutes to just be like, wow, this is really pretty.
Once
he becomes a bear, shut it off and say there's nothing of value.
I was so irritated by the, like, who the fuck do you think you are, Wes Anderson? Straighten out that aspect ratio. What are you doing? Don't do that in an animated movie. It doesn't convey anything. How dare you?
And the overall story is like revenge. You know, if you're going for revenge, dig two graves. Have respect for nature. Have respect for your loved ones. We gain meaning through our support of each other and caring. You should make amends when you do something bad. Like, that's some heavy shit. And then let's cut back to the moose being funny.
The Canadian moose.
Beauty, eh?
It is an awkward footnote in Disney's history, but it's worth seeing one or two. I'd be interested to see what kids think about it, just because like none of my friends were having kids around this time and we were adults, so like it took me years to see this fucking movie. And it was shocking.
It took me until yesterday. I wasn't going to watch this. Overall, I enjoyed it. It's a light recommend.
And it wasn't a bomb. It was produced for $50 million, $250 at the domestic box office. That ain't too shabby, even though it is not Finding Nemo's half a billion. Mm. But if you remember, California Adventure opens up, and this had a whole area. Like an entire, like a really fun obstacle course, suspended bridges with all the characters on it and the paw print in the cave. And I was there as they were taking it all down. No more brother bear for you. I don't know what this movie's legacy is. I saw Home on the Range in that Once Upon a Studio cartoon. I did not see this reference in there, but I wasn't looking very hard.
Hmm.
I did want to ask this very stupid question. Hmm. It's not this movie. Have you noticed how many animated movies are about the protagonist turning into something else?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a common theme. I mean, I think a lot of kids have always wished, what if I could fly and it was a bird?
What if I was a llama or a red panda? It
instantly gives you the fish out of water storylines. You have to learn to be a llama, learn to be a bear, whatever, and you can have comedy there.
I was just... I didn't remember it being that common. And then after this happens, it's like the plot of every other animated movie.
There's a lot of, I never thought how many there are, but yeah, I mean, it's some of that is kind of a trope going back to fairy tales. You know, you got your Princess and the Frog and stuff. So
the Little Mermaid is someone who turns into something very technically. But I've seen this a lot more since Brother Bear. And it doesn't deserve the credit. Emperor's New Groove did it as well. But it seems like something Disney goes, because there is like a cynicism behind this. Like, they wanted Lion King merch. We want talking animals. How can you do this? How can you do this in a different setting? And I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm from North America. This is inherently less interesting than animating the Serengeti.
Yeah. I mean, I like that. I do appreciate how often Disney animated movies will just be like, we're going to set it in this particular culture and we're going to spend a bunch of time researching it. No, we're not going to actually hire Inuit actors. But I mean, now they wouldn't do that. You know, for something like Moana, they would not hire Mandy Moore.
Not so here. But Brother Bear, let us know what you think, because TV has the coolest thing, my favorite thing of this week. It's not Justice League, A Better World.
That's a great episode of Justice League. You know, gets a lot of... It's not Batman the Animated Series, but it's up there next to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the episode where an alternate version, Superman, just straight up kills President Luthor, and the Justice League just morphs into fascist dictatorships. And there's the perennial comic book question, why doesn't Batman just kill the Joker? Okay, he's killed so many people. The obvious response to that is, why is it Batman's responsibility to kill the Joker? You know, Joker has killed how many Arkham guards? It's none of their responsibility to go, hey, the Joker's escaping, bang, 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 and shoot him in the back.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
isn't it all our responsibility to kill the Joker?
Yes, inside of us. Yes. The real lesson is killing the Joker, all of us, together.
Inside.
I don't know how to transition to the next thing from that. But I love Norm MacDonald, even though I didn't watch a frame of this show, which I'm sad about. A Minute with Stan Hooper.
You didn't get much of a chance. It was around for, what, six, seven episodes?
But Norm will tell you what it's about, thank goodness.
As you all know, Newsline is the highest rated news magazine in America. And my segment, A Minute with Stan Hooper, has been called the most popular minute on television. There I am, Stan Hooper. Every week I tell real stories about real people. The problem is I've always done it from this phony set in a studio in Midtown Manhattan. Well, not anymore, folks. Not anymore.
Oh, where does he go? I have not seen this.
To Hicksville. It's small town America. You know, it's not good.
Yeah, poor Norm. But he always said, like, I really just wanted to make money in stand-up. I just, there's way more money in TV and movies.
Yeah, you don't have to travel and shit. Go home every night.
And A True Calling also debuts on Fox, which, don't remember.
Well, Eliza Dushku can talk to dead people and stop them from being dead. Whoa. And this is where the kids are actually hipper than the adults, and that a lot of them know Zach Galifianakis from this show.
Oh.
We also have Kenny the Shark debuting on Discovery Kids. That's also a whoosh over my head.
Shark comes to live with a girl.
Please, JR, never go to a pitch meeting with that kind of enthusiasm. Shark lives with a girl. You get it, right? Can I go?
They told me you'd validate my parking, okay?
Shaolin Showdown debuts on Kids WB, which I meant to mention earlier. Once they announced that network, they took all of my precious cartoons away that I couldn't see anymore. My Animaniacs, my Batmans. Didn't have WB in my town, so missed this entirely.
Nah.
And the show I probably didn't watch day one, but I had a little thing called the Interwebs, where you could steal shows. And this is a show that I think more than anything really leaned into the idea that most of our viewers are not watching it live once. I've never seen a show so steer into memes, callbacks, and things you have to watch a second time to notice than the debut.
Wait.
The story of... I can't do it justice.
Now the story of a wealthy family who lost everything and the one son who had no choice but to keep them all together. It's Arrested Development.
I think one of the funniest shows of my lifetime, the first three seasons especially, Arrested Development.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And thinking about... what is this show's legacy? Because it's a show that, like, not enough people were watching. It was always about to be canceled.
Yep.
It's a weird premise. It's, you know, it's a single camera sitcom that has a continuous story. They'll try to catch you up, but you might not catch up. It doesn't matter. Sometimes not.
Sometimes
whatever.
It does. But sometimes this is on the next Arrested Development. Sometimes that never happens. Sometimes it happens 20 episodes later.
Yeah. But I was thinking about how, like, filmic this show was. Yeah. Like, it's supposed to be shot like a documentary. They used, like, high frame rate, or they used, you know, HD video cameras, but it looks really, really good.
One of the first shows to be comedies to be shot that way.
Yeah. And then looking and seeing, like, what is the trend of single camera sitcoms? And they've always been around. There've always been a couple here and there. It's around 2004, 2005. They start dominating. They start being so many of them, you know, The Office and Parks and Rec and Bored to Death and stuff. Just everything starts being filmed instead of set on a stage with a live studio audience. And I think a lot of it is because of Arrested Development and how complicated they could just set up the most complicated, goofy shit.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't want to try to do live in front of a studio audience.
I think part of that was Fox had bigger hits on its hand, but Arrested Development was, if you were on the burgeoning internet, this is a fucking phenomenon. And people want to buy merch. I bought kind of a lot of Bluth merch. I've had several Bluth moving companies mugs.
There is always money in the banana stand.
Exactly. Like which is not something like, say, Prison Break had at all. You had way more people watching that, but not wanting to live in it. And you had to have some executives paying attention, like, maybe there's money here we're ignoring. And I'm just astounded at staying on the air as long as it did. It was critically hailed from the first episode. And I remember the critics saying, like, you know, the show's funny when David Cross is the fourth funniest person on a show.
Well, yeah, they have the most stacked cast of just about any show in history. And so many of them are, you know, they're discovered here. Was it Michael Cera?
Yeah.
Definitely. Elias Shawkat, definitely. Jason Bateman. Everyone had forgotten Jason Bateman existed for 20 years.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden he's back.
Now he's amazing. Everything. My hometown hero, Tony Hale, who I watched growing up in plays that my sister would be in and stuff.
Will Arnett.
Everybody here is more famous outside of Arrested Development, and that really bums me out. They've gone on to bigger success after the show, but we wouldn't have them in those positions without without Arrested Development.
Yeah, that's a good thing. Bringing back Jeffrey Tambor, who'd been around a long time but hadn't had a big hit. Same with Jessica Walter, R.I.P. She's been around forever.
And here's
but she hadn't been allowed to be funny and realized, oh my God, she's hilarious.
Have we all seen Arrested Development a lot? Is that safe to say?
Nope.
No.
Sorry. I am at zero.
Oh.
Oh my God, you'll love it.
I've heard great things about it. I am not accepting new TV recommendations at this time. I have too much on my plate. I cannot watch Arrested Development.
Dog, load up some Mario Wonder and then put it on the second screen. Throw on some Arrested Development. Well, Diana, I'm going to do my little quiz for you.
Okay.
How does this joke end?
Oh, poor Job. This is the magic trick, huh?
Illusion, Michael. Trick is something a whore does for money.
There's little children looking at the magician. What does Job say to the children?
Oh.
A trick is something a whore does for money.
It does for money, right. I don't remember.
Damn it. Well, this isn't going to work at all.
Ah.
Because if you watch it on Netflix or if you watch it on Fox, he says to the kids, or candy. If you watch it on the DVD, which I did a billion times, he says, trick is something a whore does for money. Or cocaine. And that's on the unrated pilot, only on the DVD. I was trying to, like, how many of you have a different version of that in your head? Because this thing, no show was moving DVDs like Arrested Development. It didn't matter ultimately, and it wasn't enough to save the show. But how did that not matter? Millions of $50 as opposed to ad revenue. How does that not keep a show on the air? Because very frequently, Arrested Development DVDs would be very high. They were always like actually around 20 or 30. They were always cheap. But everybody I knew had them. I mean, even when I moved it to San Francisco and I'd meet people with like a DVD collection of less than 20, which I'm like, I already don't like you. They'd have Arrested Development in there.
Because it rewards rewatching because there are so many weird jokes, running gags, things you missed the first time around. Henry Winkler jumping over a shark.
Yes.
Missed it the first time.
Going
like a dick.
Out of their way to make a Fantastic Four movie that they then cut to Mystery Science Theater 3000 watching, and it's actually Joel and Trace doing... JR, it's a comedy nerd. Before everybody was in love with Bob Odenkirk, he pops up on this show. Every funny person does something insanely... Funny people who weren't yet rewarded like they should have been pop up on Arrested Development, and it's awesome. It is for comedy nerds. Please watch it. Netflix, we almost lost it, or part of it. So hopefully Netflix never gets rid of it. It almost did, meaning there would be two seasons that are not on DVD and wouldn't be able to be streamed anywhere but Netflix. But if they don't own the rights to Arrested Development, they can't really show it. It got a stay of execution, but I don't know how much longer we'll have it. So thoroughly recommended. Can't say as much for the Treehouse of Horror 14, just because I don't remember it. Reaper Madness, Frankenstein, and Stop the World, I Want to Goof Off.
I know I've watched this, but I haven't watched it 10 times or 20 times, which is how many I've watched for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. So I rewatched it, and it's actually a lot of fun. Reaper Madness is Homer kills Death. And then so for a while, no one is dying. And then he ends up taking on the mantle and has to go do death stuff.
Hell yeah.
Stop the World, I Want to Goof Off is, oh, what's the movie with the kids and they have a watch? There's also a Twilight Zone episode, but idea that Bart and Milhouse have a stopwatch that can stop time and they use it to prank people and then it breaks and they're just stuck in the same moment forever.
Okay, yes, I have seen that.
I think the real good one, though, is Frankenstein, which is about Professor Frank bringing back his dad. And, of course, his dad is played by Jerry Lewis.
Hell yeah.
So, yeah. And they actually got a Nobel Prize winning, like, chemist to co-star in it.
Wow.
Because it's about Frank winning a Nobel Prize. They actually went and found somebody. It's like, what? We don't have the difference.
I guarantee you there are Nobel Prize winners who would be like, I'll be on The Simpsons 100%. Yeah, yes.
Yeah. Stephen Hawking has a Simpsons action figure. I think more than one. Did he win a Nobel? I don't know. But yeah, The Simpsons, 14th Treehouse of Horror. I have not seen the new one yet. I'm looking forward to it. Video games of 2003. Some incredible biggies here. Obviously the biggest, WWE SmackDown, Here Comes the Pain. Even Diana couldn't stop playing this on PS2. A game I know I bought for my ex-girlfriend, and she hated, Harry Potter Quidditch World Cup. They didn't have a Harry Potter movie game this year, so they made like an NBA Jam for Quidditch.
It's a solid idea, except that Quidditch is the dumbest design sport of all time.
Yeah. And then the game ends when somebody wins the lottery, and that's what happens. SpongeBob SquarePants Battle for Bikini Bottom, which I think recently got a rehydrated version.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. So I wasn't playing this. So, but I don't know which one is bigger. Well, I do. But for me, Tony Hawk's Underground, I remember refreshing the IGN page. Oh, what did this make? I want the new Tony Hawk so bad. Like caring about this series that much feels crazy. But like, Tony Hawk was an amazing experience, and this was like, dude, we're going open world story missions. Oh, it's going to be like, this is too much. There doesn't need to be this many cutscenes in a Tony Hawk game. It kind of reaffirms all the Jackass people basically get to take over the Tony Hawk games for the next two with the Underground series. Oh, wait, no, Tony Hawk Underground. Yeah, that's what it is. Thug. Thug, that's the acronym. And then perhaps the biggest one, Call of Duty. Debuts on Windows.
Literally just trying to count right now how many Call of Duty games there are.
Don't try, Diane. It's too hard. It's not an annual series yet because it's kind of a slow burn. Because it's really my first memory of seeing Call of Duty. I'm at my friend's house where we all hang out. They play a lot of MMOs and they have really beefy computers, and there's this demo for this new war game, and we're just marveling at like its AI, its lighting. That's not really what the Call of Duty series is known for at this point, but like a World War II, like a very dramatic World War II where you're commanding your fellow officers, do you go here? Like none of this do I associate with modern Call of Duty, which is I still play Call of Duty, but is cinematic single player Twitch multiplayer. And even the Call of Duty people I read this week were like, we had to realize at some point we're not Counter-Strike, we're something different, we're a different kind of shooter. But it's Call of Duty 1 is like almost unrecognizable compared to the goals of the newer Call of Duties.
There are an even 20 Call of Duties and they become annual starting Call of Duty 2 in 2005.
Yes.
Boom, boom, boom.
I was gonna like guess that. 06, but yeah, 2000. Yeah, once Activision gets its hands on it, Call of Duty is a kind of keeping that entire company afloat, to be honest.
Wow.
Anyway, Call of Duty, happy birthday. Let's close out this segment with Defying Gravity by Idina Menzel from the Wicked soundtrack. But don't go anywhere. We got one more segment.
You got to do that final yell, man. And otherwise, the musical fans would come and beat on me.
All right.
Tiny fist.
We'll get it in there. But stay right there. We got one more segment. Don't move. At least I'm flying free.
We'll be right back.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Internet and all the ships at sea. It's time for Diana's Classic Corner, where we go even further back in time this week to see if there's anything worth a watching. And for the week of October 27th through November 2nd, happy spooky season! I have a spooky recommendation, but I'm going to start with the less spooky recommendation. Turning 70 years old from 1953 is a Japanese film called Gate of Hell, which is, I try to shout out, like, the most gorgeous movies ever made. And I already talked about the red shoes. And I got to talk about Gate of Hell. I think it's like the first color film from Japan that was released outside of Japan. Considering it's 1953 and, you know, there had been the unpleasantness less than 10 years ago. I don't know how they made a movie so incredibly gorgeous. It's a pretty simple story of, like, there's, you know, a bunch of, there's like a little caravan and some bandits attack and the samurai saves the people from the bandit attack and he falls in love with this woman, but like she's already married and it kind of drives him nuts and he needs to love her so much, but you know, that's not going to happen. And the gate of hell is not, you know, like a hell mouth or anything. It's more of being stuck on the horns of trying to figure out these emotions and also act properly in, you know, the middle of the Heiji rebellion. And it is one of the most gorgeous looking movies I have ever fucking seen. Find it in as high def as possible. I know it's been restored. Maybe it's out there in 4K, whatever it is. It uses color like they've cornered the market on color. Like, there will never be color ever like this again. Like, they're using all of the color. Every set, every costume, every location is just awash in these stunning, deep, rich colors. That's just like, I kind of want to live there, except I don't want to get attacked by bandits and samurais and stuff. So, you know, but yeah, Gate of Hell, it's directed by Tainosuke Kunugasa, whose work I don't know much about. I guess he did some silent stuff that's a little more avant-garde, Crossroads back to 1928. But Gate of Hell is stunning, really interesting movie, and short. It's like 80-something minutes. And it'll just blow you away. It is gorgeous. And then, for spooky season, turning 90 years old. 90 years old from 1933. It is The Invisible Man. Yay, Invisible Man. Starring Claude Rains, Gloria Stewart. Yep, the old lady from Titanic when she was young and hot. The Universal monster movies, they actually cover about 20 years, starting with Dracula and, like, Creature in the Black Lagoon. They usually fold in, even though that's, like, 20 years later. Of the first run in the 30s, from Dracula through, like, Tower of London or so, this is one of the best. I really love this because of how fucking insane Claude Rains gets. He's, you know, it's kind of a theme that they ended up using in, like, Hollow Man, of all things. The idea of, like, well, if you don't have to look at yourself in the mirror, you can do pretty much anything. And he goes nuts. And the effects for 90 years ago are so good. I don't really want to spoil how they did them, because he starts unwrapping his head and there ain't no head there. And you're like, people must have screamed in the audience. Like, I don't know. Well, I mean, I know how they did that. I wouldn't have understood how they did it at the time. The Invisible Man is, yeah, one of my favorites of the original run of horror movies. The Mummy and Bride of Frankenstein, those are probably only two ahead of it. And then later on, eventually, you get to The Wolfman in the 40s, which I like, and Creature of the Black Lagoon in the 50s. But of that early, we're talking about the first horror films ever made, proper horror films. Yeah, The Invisible Man's absolutely one of the best. Total recommend. And that's it for this week. Stay spooky.
Coming into Here's the Never Growing Up by Avril Lavigne off of her self-titled album, You Go Avril. Welcome to our final segment of 30-20-10, the 10 2013, 10 years ago, October 27th through November 2nd. Other new albums that came out 10 years ago, Nighttime, My Time by Sky Fiera. Fiera? Oh, my God. Corsicana at Lemonade by White Denim. Nocturnal by Yuna. Love Me Back to Life by Celine Dion. Free Your Mind by Cut Copy and the self-titled album by James Arthur, as well as Matangi by MIA. Royals by Lord is still number one. Oh, my God. So much... I have to cover all this death for 2013. Are we still at war?
Yes.
So I threw these in. 18 people are killed by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan. 38 people are killed in Baghdad. And absolutely nothing is remarkable about those bombings, listeners. I scroll through all the news events of 2013 to decide what we're going to put on, as well as Diana. And it's a steady tick, mm-hmm. you know. Month after month, week after week, there's always something like this just ticking by and ticking by. So I can't mention it every week, but I just want to throw it in to put you in the world of 2013. These were happening every time, so much that you'd barely notice it when it did.
It's not the first, it's not the last, it's not the biggest. It just keeps fucking happening.
Yep.
Well. Thank God we have nothing like that to worry about 10 years on. Moving on. Moving on to the movies. This will put you in a good mood. It's Keith David, Cole Meany, George Takei, Amy Poehler, and Woody Harrelson and Owen Wilson in Free Birds.
I love all these people.
Yeah, you're going to love this movie.
I turned this movie off.
It's pretty reprehensible. I haven't watched this movie since I wrote that article on a very rare phenomenon, which is real-world products in kids' cartoons. Mm. Television has rules against this, that you can't have product placement in children's entertainment because, you know, it's kind of all product placement if you think about it. It's very rare that movies do that. If you've seen the B-movie and like, man, I love a Cinnabon. Like, it's very weird to have a real product. It's very weird to have Alvin reach for Honey Nut Cheerios, the Alvin and the Chipmunks first animated movie. Chuck E. Cheese is featured in the movie Free Birds. As if that's not irritating you at all, it's as delivery pizza, which they didn't even do for decades until the pandemic. And even then they have to, do you remember what they had to masquerade as Chuck E. Cheese to sell pizza?
They had a different name. And yeah, I saw people figuring it out online, putting it together.
Pasquale's Pizza. The Italian drummer in the Chuck E. Cheese band. And I love that because Denny's had to do it. Hooters had to do it because, wow, people fucking hate your food. And if they can intentionally not eat it, they will. So you have to you guys have a way bigger problem than the pandemic on your hand. But Freebirds, there's nothing remarkable about it other than that. Because it's always jarring to see a real actual product in a cartoon.
Well, I feel like this is bizarre. Like, okay, we're trying to make a Thanksgiving movie for kids.
That's what I was going to say. Feel like this was like scientifically engineered. We will be the Thanksgiving film for the next 30 years.
But it's premised on the idea that your kid is going to cry when they see the turkey come out of the oven because the turkeys are its friends that it knows from the movie, where the turkey that's being pardoned by the president, so he's the one turkey whose life is not on the line, then has to go back in time to the first Thanksgiving to try to make turkeys not on the menu, which every history dork will tell, they weren't on the menu at the first Thanksgiving.
Oh my gosh. I am shocked that this movie has a historical inaccuracy.
Let's write to the president of history and tell him.
You weren't shocked by the Chuck E. Cheese delivery food? I'm appalled by that.
This is such a weird idea. Okay, yeah, the idea that you should make a movie about Thanksgiving turkeys not wanting to be eaten. Okay, fine. But you really make it as like, yes, this is a turkey holocaust that happens every year. And they're all traumatized by it. And now your kids at Thanksgiving are going to lose their shit.
Okay.
Because Owen Wilson is coming out of the oven.
Counter argument. When the movie Chicken Run came out, which is all about chickens being trapped, mm-hmm. McDonald's had a tie-in with that film for their chicken nuggets.
Perfect.
So you would have chicken nuggets for Chicken Run. I don't think they're going to think that much about the bird in the oven.
I think the McNuggets is in the name of the second movie. Matt has seen it, by the way. Very jealous of him. Saw it at the Animation Festival in L.A. this weekend.
Yeah, looking forward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, Freebirds, like I said, I turned it off once the time travel kicked in. And according to reviews, I went too far. Anyway, I should have avoided that. It is nonsensical and confusing and frantic. And why would you do this?
See, I think this is the first movie I took my daughter to in theaters for her to watch.
Wow.
She was 3 years old, so kind of young, but still able to watch some movies. So I think this was the first one that we ever saw together.
Why
and
this?
I have no nostalgia for it at all. It is not a special memory in the slightest. I haven't seen it since.
You didn't save the stub? It's not in the scrapbook somewhere?
No, no.
But why this? Were you stuck?
Because it was out. It was a cartoon that was out at the time when I thought maybe she's old enough to go see it.
She should not see any other movie released this week, for sure. For sure.
I would agree with that.
But
this is down the memory hole. No one remembers this film at all. And I still think we are aching for a Thanksgiving movie.
Yeah. There's only like
Nightmare Before Christmas. He goes to Thanksgiving land. Nah, we're always talking about it already.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Nothing can beat it. Nothing can beat it. Take that home for the holidays or whatever else there is. You want the movie? I kind of hate it, but like it's not for me, and that's okay. But it's probably not for our audience either. Mary Steenburgen, Kevin Kline, Michael Douglas, Morgan Freeman, Robert De Niro, the Avengers of old people. It's Las Vegas.
Girls, I'm getting married.
The bachelor party in Vegas.
Can't smoke, drink, eat salt, or stay out past 9. But
on November 1st.
Welcome to Las Vegas.
One comedy proves it's never too late to start the party.
What's it gonna take?
18. Run, shoot.
$1,800.
You kidding me?
Get into trouble.
Everything all right here?
What, you his bodyguard?
Perhaps.
No one calls us names except us.
And try something new.
This red ball of vodka's are strange. I'm getting drunk and electrocuted at the same time.
Las Vegas.
It's so... All these people are still working, and they did their old person, we're too old to be doing this stuff 10 years ago.
Yeah. This was the best ad I found, that there were other ads that were literally just these actors talking about, I've never worked with any of these people before. Isn't that crazy? And you're right. That is crazy. How have De Niro and Morgan Freeman never been in a movie together?
And also, like, in my mind, how... Kevin Kline isn't the same age as all these people, is he?
You know, I double-checked on everyone's age. There is a 10-year gap between the oldest and youngest here.
Okay.
But the idea that they were friends as kids makes that a little tougher to buy, but 10 years is actually pretty respectable.
Sure.
Like, okay, there is, I was expecting there's one guy who's 25 years younger, and you're like, come on! Nope, 10 years.
I hated this, but it is, like, I don't know, not looking forward to being this age. I don't idealize anything about it. I don't know. It's a movie made for olds. There's no enjoyment to be had in this film for anybody under 50.
Well, look, was The Hangover a little too fast-paced for you?
Yeah. No.
You want a gentler Hangover. That should just be what it's called, gentle Hangover.
Yeah, I think it
like,
sucks.
There are some good jokes in here, and everyone is so charming that elevated the material. I'll give them that.
Kevin Kline was in a different movie.
Yeah, Kevin Kline's in a different movie. Mary Steenburgen comes in from yet another movie. But everyone's like, it's charming. They seem to be having a good time. It's that kind of Adam Sandler thing of like, well, it's fun to see them having a nice time. No one had to do anything that was like so grotesque. I felt embarrassed for them.
No, I would call this boomer humor the movie.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a lot of that.
Didn't like. But I'm saying it's not for me. My dad is the audience for this film, and I hope he enjoyed it. But bah.
Again, we don't get old people movie that often.
Yeah, yeah. We will get ours. We will definitely. I can't wait for ours. Chris Pratt and Owen Wilson are being sent to a home against their will.
Yeah. So like my expectations were so fucking low, and then it exceeded them. Good for you. Not enough to recommend, but at least I'm not furious at it.
Yeah, I'm not mad at it.
I'm not mad at it either.
That's so right, listeners. This gets a 3 not mad.
3 not mad at it. It's on Netflix, so it's easy to see. I'm baffled that someone thought the next movie was a good idea. I know why they thought it was a good idea. But it was a fascinating watch, and I really have to imagine JR will have more to say about the next film. Viola Davis, Abigail Breslin, Ben Kingsley, Hayley Stanfield, Harrison Ford, and Asa Butterfield. It's number one this week, but it's a huge bomb. It's Ender's Game.
The aliens nearly destroyed us.
We need minds like yours, Ender. Because of you, the invaders might leave us alone.
Is there more us?
No. There's another way. Your thoughts, my dreams, all mixed together.
Ender! It's not safe!
We can't lose him.
That's all that matters.
It's no longer a game.
Ender's Game, rated PG-13.
I should say I saw for the first time and kind of enjoyed it. I have no familiarity with the source material.
And that's the thing. This book is a sci-fi classic. I read it probably at 19, maybe 20, blown away by it. It's an incredible novel, really well known in the sci-fi community. It tackles the internal emotional life of Ender, who is a young boy plucked to lead a war effort, and he goes under a series of training over the course of a decade in the novel in order that he can lead humanity's fleet, which this is a slower than light universe. So the fleet is taking like 50, 60 years to arrive at the enemy, and their hope is that they can find a general to lead it by the time the last fleet arrives to attack the enemy home world. And they're hoping that Ender will be that guy. This does a good job of adapting that novel to the screen, as I think you could hope for, with a couple of caveats. It's too big. It really would work much better as a miniseries than it would as a movie. And they kind of throw in the ending without the buildup that it has in the novel.
It is hyper abrupt.
100%. And it's, okay, listeners, spoilers. It's like the whole thrust of the thing is Ender is training. Ender is playing a game.
It makes sense that they get kids who have better reflexes and are more malleable to get really good at drone simulations. So these kids play simulations of war over and over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, you go to the pro gaming circuit, there's no 40-year-olds there. There's not.
I remember when I was gaming the most, we had a friend who was, we're like 21 and he's 18. Like, we can show him stuff, but we can't teach him anything. He's too good. He's too good.
Mm-hmm. So is the ending maybe the tagline of the movie? This is not a game.
Yes.
God damn it. Like I wasn't going to figure that out. I've never read these books. I know nothing about them. And I was like, what's this about? Oh, that sounds like it's a cult indoctrinating a guy and tricking him into genocide. Cool. Cool, cool, cool.
Yeah, that is the thrust of it. It's handled a lot better in the book, I will say that. And I would definitely recommend the book. I might give this a light recommend with the caveat.
Butterfield is fucking great. That kid rules.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I think he goes through puberty like in this production because his voice his voice kind of changes. But like he is... That's the weird thing about the weirdest takeaway for me about the movie. This looks like a kids movie because it's all starring kids. Kids aren't going to get a fucking thing out of this at all. This is a movie for adults starring a shitload of kids.
Right. You can make a movie starring kids that's for adults, and that's what the novel is. One of the scenes from the novel that stuck in my brain for the last 25 years is where Ender is playing a video game where he always loses. He's up against this giant and he's controlling the mouse, and no matter what he does, he always loses. So one time he just has the mouse dig into the giant's eye and eat through it to get to the giant's brain. And this is described in graphic detail, and the people watching him are, what the fuck did he just do there? And the general is like, that's the kind of thinking we need. That's not something for kids. That shouldn't be a kids movie scene, but it's a powerful scene in the book, and they kind of miff its execution in this movie because it's just, they're trying too much.
Yeah, I think they wanted Star Wars money from this, but like these kids are behaving like they're more behaved than the soldiers in Full Metal Jacket. This is super serial, and it makes it fascinating. And I could see the ending coming a mile away.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's part of my problem is that so much of it. Well, the ending feels like a setup for the rest of the book series, because there's a whole pile of books, and I've heard that the next one is the best one. But I ended up, I did not care. I don't know what it was. Like, they're trying to get me to care. The visuals are very impressive a lot of the time. And just, yeah, the idea of recruiting kids for this thing that, you know, eventually we'll get there and you'll be old enough and then we'll be ready. Like, okay, that's an interesting idea. Why am I so bored?
I never... Just,
it did not connect with me at all.
I'd hate to talk spoilers, but this is like a fucking 50-year-old story and a 10-year-old movie. So in case we weren't clear, they're fighting the last simulation. And wouldn't you know it? Like, Ender does it. They win. They beat it. And everyone cheers. And the screens turn off. And then it's revealed by the screen flickering back on that that wasn't a simulation. You just committed genocide. And then, like, so a technical error revealed this to them? And then, like, the adult Sherman, like, yeah, Ender, you were doing this all for real this whole time. Yeah, we were going to tell you, I guess. And he's like, no! The ramification, like... No, he's a military indoctrinated kid. This would not be his reaction. He would be very chad about it.
Well,
okay.
Well, in the book, it's all about how the reason Ender is successful is because he's empathetic. He can put himself in the minds of the people he's defeating. And again, that's something very hard to capture in a non-literary format.
And it runs from that abruptness into, like, headlong for a sequel in a way, like, you know, I was looking at my phone from time to time, like, was this always an option? You could have run away and no one would have come after you. And
well, Ender is a bullet. They do not care about him as a person. They only care about him as a tool in their war machine, in which in their minds depends the survival of the entire human race. As such, no, they don't care about Ender. But once he's won the war, then they're just like, sure, yeah.
This all takes place in like seconds. They knock his ass out.
It is a horrible ending.
It's clumsy.
If I'm workshopping it, I would have had Harrison Ford fall to his knees after being this stoic father figure the whole time and just start bawling his eyes out, and then have Ender going, why are you crying?
Yeah.
What is going on? And then just have him just be in tears, being like, you won, you won. And Ender going, like, it was a simulation. Why do you care? And then just be like, you saved us all. Kapow. Then the realization hits.
Yeah. And then all the, they were just trying to settle somewhere and we murdered all of them. Why are we going to their current home and they're not fighting us now?
Because there's no way to communicate with them. Apparently, again, this is the book and this is not explored that well in the movie. They're not verbal creatures. They're not even sentient as you and I are sentient. Mm-hmm. They are a hive mind. They do not understand that we are not a hive mind. When they killed our colony, which they did, they landed and killed a bunch of humans, they thought that was just the same as like you and I cutting off someone's hair.
Not totally established in the movie. So, like,
nope.
I enjoyed this. I think I thought I would hate it, but I thought it was at least well done, if not representative of, you know, the story by a, you know, bigot. And
that ended up being the big talk at the time because Orson Scott Card has an issue with Tigays.
Yeah.
Which is like, okay, fine. Have an issue with Tigays. I don't have to give you my Timoney.
Yeah, it's not like someone like him will ever be a president or Speaker of the House. whoops-a-daisy. But I don't know. How do you feel about the movie as far as recommending it?
It's a light recommend. If you're looking for a sci-fi universe you have not seen before,
this is
a decent one, just as something to explore. I thought the space battle at the end was good because they actually had tactics in it. Usually space battles are just like, look at all the light shining.
Yeah.
This one had a real strategy.
Grab the MacGuffin. It should heal everything.
Let's just pew-pew at each other, and somehow I'm never hit, and I hit all of them.
Couldn't help but think of Starship Troopers, though. Just saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Much prefer that. Ender's Game. And it was the end of Ender's Game.
Yeah, this... just about made its money back, which means it lost a ton of money because they promoted the Jesus out of this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're not going to get Speaker of the Dead, everyone. Sorry.
Yeah, it's weird because I can see why they wanted to make it, because the young adult fandom is here and willing to pour money into things that are a little darker and heavier.
I mean, it's a recognized title. Yeah. We have a Hunger Games coming very shortly.
Oh, I thought it was already out. So, okay.
No, we have another Hunger Games on the way. So.
Yeah.
Twilight is done.
Twilight
but,
is done.
Yeah. But Hunger Games was massive. And so we have, and because Harry Potter's done also, this is, we're going to be pointing at this sort of thing, the often post-apocalyptic teenagers versus a technocracy kind of thing.
It shows you where Lionsgate head was at. And it's smart moves all around. Moving on to TV of 2013, October 27th through November 2nd, The Governor's Wife debuts on A&E, a channel I haven't watched in 30 years.
This is about a literal, it's a reality show about a governor's wife, and the former government had recently got it out of federal prison.
What? Cool.
Yeah. Former Louisiana Governor Edwin Edwards. He had just gotten out of prison for bribery and extortion. He is 86. The wife of the title is 35.
Hell
she is
yeah.
half the age of his children.
He's half a century younger than you. Oh my God.
Yeah. So, yeah, this went 8 episodes. Not trashy enough, I guess. I don't know.
A show I can't say that I watched, but it had a good YouTube presence. I believe Conan's swinging his right weight around to give Pete Holmes his own show. I believe on the week his comedy special is out. I just saw him.
Yeah, I have watched all the X-Men. Mm-hmm. I've watched all the Street Fighter red tapes. I've never seen a frame of this on TBS.
He had interviews with like fun, like podcasty sort of interviews with stand-up comedians as well. And I only saw it on YouTube. So, but yeah, always kind of like Pete Holmes and that was the hallmark, the things that still get passed around, him doing a job interview for all the X-Men and Street Fighter characters. Pretty brilliant.
Let's listen to Gambit's exit interview real quick.
This Thomas Middleditch's Gambit.
Yeah.
So Gambit, you throw stuff.
Yeah, I tap into the energy of an object and I turn it into kinetic energy.
And then you throw it.
Yeah, I throw it. I throw it really hard.
Yes. I'm just going to keep it then as throws stuff, which is what I had. Gambit, my question then is, what happens if you run out of stuff?
But there's always stuff to throw.
There's always stuff.
Yeah, and I got my playing cards.
Right, you. Great to have you on the team.
That was tough because, you know.
They're all great. Look them all up on YouTube.
I mean,
all the X-Men, all the Street Fighters.
To me, it was just these becoming popular. And still, you still see TikToks of them and shit. It was the mainstreamification of geekdom, which I don't feel happened until like 10 years ago. Like,
farther back. We're past the Avengers, man.
I'm just saying about on television. And I remember when Chappelle's show did a GTA sketch, and it was just like, I think it wasn't so much that like the acceptance wasn't there as that the writers were too old to propose such a thing. So what we're seeing basically is my generation becoming writers. That's probably more what I'm getting at. If we want to move beyond my generation, Conan O'Brien airs a week of retrospectives for Conan's 20th anniversary as a late night TV host. That's such a sad moniker he has to use because he's on TBS now. But the show was allowed to use clips from Late Night with Conan O'Brien and The Tonight Show on its website on loan from NBC Archives until November 15th. I think his YouTube channel got the rights to use at least the Late Show clips again, which is kind of beautiful because Conan O'Brien said he only cared about, I just wanted to have like a accessible body of work. And now it's kind of under the same umbrella as Team Coco and everything else. I think that's cool. So I love Coco.
Yeah.
And if you didn't see his podcast this week, 302010 fans, it's Dave Grohl, Chris Novoselic, and producer Steve Albini talking about In Utero.
Ooh.
Because he was like, like the second week of my show, I bought this album. So it was like the soundtrack to my personal madness. And a really in-depth look at the making of the last Nirvana album, curiously enough, from Conan's podcast. Cool. Tangential connection with Conan. Not that tangential. He's a writer for SNL. And this week, SNL, facing criticism for lacking African-American women, its cast, they make light of the controversy by having guest host Kerry Washington play both the First Lady and Oprah Winfrey in its cold open, along with an explanation-blazed disclaimer. SNL would readdress this next year with the wonderful Shishir Zamata, which I saw her do stand-up. And she, I love paraphrase. I not going to do it justice. He's like, everyone thinks my name is exotic, but I'm from a much larger minority, black nerds. My name is a Star Trek reference. it is not anything African. It is love in an original series. Love or a flower in the original series Star Trek. And then, we should just mention Treehouse of Horrors 10 years ago aired earlier in October, the earliest any Treehouse of Horror has ever aired, but it did not come out this week. So fuck it. And I want to go watch the new one.
You got to cover it, man. So, yep. That's got Wanted, Dead, Then Alive, Homerzilla, and Telepaths of Glory, which, love that title.
Oh, my God.
I've no idea why it aired so early. I mean, October 6th, there wasn't baseball. I mean,
only imagine that it was streaming. So airing it earlier,
The Simpsons had not started streaming in 2013.
Okay.
Had not.
Really? No. It's not on Hulu yet? I'm pretty sure it was on Hulu.
Nope. No.
I don't think so. No.
Okay. Could be wrong. 2013 video games, and it is a big week for video games all around. Assassin's Creed 4, Black Flag. For many, I think even JR considered one of the best Assassin's Creeds ever.
I haven't played enough Assassin's Creed games to say that. I've only played like two, but I will say I think this is the best pirate action game of all time.
Yeah.
You get to do everything you want as a pirate, and you get to collect sea shanties. You can go around and you collect them, then your crewmates start singing them after you collect them. How cool is that? And you get to, you know, sail a ship and fight as a pirate and take booty and all the things you could want in a pirate game. This pretty much has.
Battlefield 4 is out for PC and PS360. I think this is Battlefield 3 was it's like, we're going to answer Call of Duty 10 years later and its dominance in the multiplayer world and neglected a campaign. And I think 4 added one, and it's the last Battlefield I've ever played. Oh. Battlefield 4.
It takes place in the far off year of 2020.
No!
There's a war between the U.S. and Russia at that time.
Oh.
And, you know, gotta say, close. You know, given how well they're doing against the Ukraine, Battlefield, you owe the world an apology for how competently you played the Russian Federation as opponents.
Oh, right. Still holding them at bay, the Ukraine. Pac-Man and the Ghostly Adventures. Jesus. Is this based off the cartoon?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh. So don't be interested. Sonic Lost World. Pretty cool Sonic game and the last of, I think, the Nintendo exclusivity for Wii U and 3DS.
Yeah, you team up with Eggman on this one, so you're both on the same side.
And there are, I think at this point, lost DLC levels with Nintendo outfits, or do you collect rupees? I'm trying to remember exactly what they were. Yoshi might be in it. That might be lost to time, unless Nintendo decides to re-releasing. Stop it. The Typing the Dead Overkill, which is fantastic.
I love the idea for this series so much.
I mean, Overkill was a game for the Wii, which was a grindhousey version of House of the Dead, which was not without its charm, but not great. Typing of the Dead is hilarious and a much better venue for grindhouse horror because you are literally learning to type. Oh, I got to bust out my Dreamcast keyboard. I have it somewhere. Not lastly, Bubsy 3D, Bubsy Visits the James Turrell Retrospective, which I'm like, I remember what? This wasn't a real game, but it kind of was. Yeah, it was on PC and Mac. I don't know if Bubsy's public domain or the 3D.
He's not. I just think the brand was so
dead,
worthless at this point that it was just the like fuck it attitude.
Yeah, I saw it was in honor of Bubsy's 18th anniversary. Like, who celebrates an 18th anniversary other than a human child?
And so he goes to the LA County Museum of Art and looks at the James Turrell retrospective.
Yes.
That's the game?
Partially.
Well, he dies in the museum.
Yes.
He then descends to hell, and then it gets even weirder from there.
Oh, okay. I'm seeing something about an Applebee's parking lot. Okay. I'm not going to try to understand this.
And it's the kind of shit that usually happens with Sonic as far as fan-made games. And
Is he pregnant at the time or no?
I resent having... If I said I'm mad at Nintendo earlier, it's because I resent having to say this title. We Fit You for Wii U is out, which at some point, if I have to say that again, I'll feel like I'm speaking a different language, because I really hate all these, the branding of this entire system. My least favorite Nintendo system, the Wii U.
Yeah, that's fair. This is the only game that ever uses Wii U Fit board.
Because I didn't buy in on the stupid Wii Fit thing. Got my mother to buy her first and only game console. Probably saw a Today Show episode where they told her she could lose weight at the TV. There's a Wii U in my house to this day because of Wii Fit and how well that sold, and that success was never recaptured. But, well, we are almost out of show. We're going to tell you who died and do a little quiz. You can play along with about who was born during this segment, but let's get some plugs out because we didn't, at the top, say anything about patreon.com/lasertime. You don't want to go spooky season without the brand new season of Elm Street Nightmare, season 4, all about Evil Dead. And we talk about all 5 movies and a little episode about Ash versus Evil Dead. A fantastic show. Even Evil Dead fans haven't seen, as far as I can tell. That's great. It's on Hulu. More stuff always coming there. Hundreds of podcasts. Help support us. $5. All we ask. Give us more. Give us less. But $5 is what we're asking for. Love you. Thank you for your continued support. Seriously. And thanks for listening. Diana, where can folks find you?
Right now, they can find me on the Blue Sky at ListeningNerd, LeCinenerd. Next week, we have a really packed show next week.
Oh, no.
We have 3 different part 3s. Two of them are like the nadir of the series, and one of them is up for debate. We'll see. Let's just say I didn't like The Matrix.
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Oh,
we're going to see how is this one going to stack up. We also have the Best Picture winner of 2013 up against what is generally regarded as the worst of the MCU movies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
I have not reappraised it, so we shall see. And then, so 2003, it turns out, is an amazing year for Christmas movies. I want everyone out there to think of a modern Christmas movie that is a classic now. There is an 80% chance that you just thought of one of the 3 movies we're going to be talking about from 2003. Nuts. This one, the first one up, is a comedy classic, and we get to find out whether Santa sits on a throne of lies.
And if that wasn't enough, we also get the most nasally sitcom of all time making its premiere.
Oh, what? Trying to think of what that would be. Good tease.
The final appearance of the complete original Star Trek cast.
Oh, wow.
It's Welshie here on out. A psychotic anthropomorphic rabbit and a dog detective will hit the road. The best Lord of the Ring movie game, so based on the movie, of all time will make its premiere. And just gonna say it, Steven Universe.
That's 10 years. Whoa.
Sorry, you're old.
God, I'm Matt Damoning right in front of everybody. Oh my. 10 years old.
So old.
I'm hip. I'm with it. I watched the kids' cartoons on the TV 10 years ago.
No.
Oh, no.
Everything I think of as new is 10 years old.
Sucks. Lord and what's your name? Lizzo and Steven Universe. All the new stuff. Oh, I suck. All that nonsense out of the way. Die who died.
Well, in 1993, we talked about River Phoenix, who was only 23, exactly 50 years older than him. And on the same day, Halloween, we lost Federico Fellini, who was 73.
God, I want to die on Halloween.
It is a cool time to die on Halloween.
Let me just put it out. If I die on Halloween, I'm going to come back every year and y'all got to like do stuff or something. But how did Harry Houdini do it?
You're supposed to try to have a seance and you've got like a secret code.
I
to tell
make people
someone,
wonder forever, like Andy Kaufman.
It never worked out. And then in 2013, that's when we lost Lou Reed, who was 71. And Transformers, an amazing album.
Oh, shit! And you got one of my favorite MST3K jams as the closing.
I have to. Yeah. Like, I have a lot of Lou Reed and Velvet Underground songs that I love, but there's very few that are, like, pleasant. This is one of the ones that is like, I'm enjoying this.
Oh.
Let's hug and slow dance.
You don't like Lou Reed, the rapper? Pretty good.
No.
Was the Satellite of Love on MST3K named after that?
No.
I believe it's named after the same thing that the song is named after.
Yeah, the I think what Jerry Lewis would refer to where the signals were coming in from the telethon. All coming in from the satellite of love, or however you do a Jerry Lewis impression.
Yeah,
that was good.
I lost it.
Well, with the deaths come the
birthday
quiz.
Eat birthdays. Birthday.
Oh, birthday is a doodly doo, a ding dong doodly doodly ding dong doo.
Turning 60 years old, born on Halloween, 1963, in San Francisco.
Woo.
His mother was a kindergarten teacher and his father a real estate broker. His father was Jewish and his mother was of partial Filipino descent.
So not Jewish.
Oh, I think I know who this could be.
Wait, I'm going to take a wild stab in the dark here.
Okay. Kat,
do I dare?
Let me tell you.
Was this person in Surf Ninjas?
Okay, we're thinking the same person.
Surf Ninjas. Yeah! Some other roles this person has played
include
Tiny Elvis, Orgasm Guy, Richard Lamer, which is the official name of the Making Copies guy.
Rich Meister.
He starred in Surf Ninjas, Judge Dredd, The Beverly Hillbillies, Home Alone 2, Demolition Man, Down Periscope, Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo, its 2005 sequel, The Animal, The Hot Chick, Bench Warmers, Big Stan, and every single Adam Sandler movie ever.
And except for that one year they had a falling out. But
did Adam Sandler get vaccinated?
He also had a sitcom called Rob, which was loosely based on his own life.
Yuck. And the Netflix one is even worse. I've seen both.
It was about his wife is Hispanic, and it was about her like extended family, and it was called Rob, but it's got the exclamation point upside down at the beginning, like you do in Spanish, so it looked like it was called iRob.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Rob Schneider, everybody.
Rob Schneider. A waste.
I have never liked you.
I did, but like him less than I did. I wasn't even sure he was Jewish. So to hear him go and like, this is the most persecuted time for people like me. Imagine Rob, Mr. Snyder, please. What are we doing?
I feel like he kind of, well, I think his mom is Filipino.
Yes. Partial Filipino.
Oh, partially. So I think
she's
he played
not even
that
a full
as
Filipino.
He's allowed to play,
any ethnicity ever.
he gets to play like really, really stereotypical Asian folks because he's like, but I'm Asian.
It's bizarre, but SNL has done blackface, but they haven't really done yellow. I mentioned that previously.
Oh, SNL used to do yellowface.
Did they?
Dana Carvey had a
character. Oh, that's right.
That
he did. But
really just yellowface.
Yes, he did. But I just remember like Rob Schneider would play Sunni. I'm like, ooh, that's not going to hold up well. I'm like, oh, Rob Schneider's patient. Okay, then I guess he's allowed? I don't make the rules.
He's okay. I have no idea what the cutoff is for part Asian, but I will tell you, once you get like Johnny Depp levels, no, you don't get a pass.
Well, I will say he is from just south of San Francisco, part of the Bay Area that is like majority Filipino. Yes, I say that as someone who lives there. Daly City, Pacifica. Yeah, I hear Tagalog more than I hear English.
His maternal grandmother was Filipina.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So one quarter then?
One quarter.
Yeah, one quarter. But, what, you know, whatever.
Yeah, who gives a shit?
Look, that's not my problem with the man. Mm-hmm. My problems with the man are much more extensive. Vaccinate yo kids.
Diana Goodman, judging the Rob Meister, having opinions on Rob Schneider, does not like his unscientific worldview.
Yeah, you know who still has their COVID gold star? This lady. You know who's gotten all of her shots? This lady.
Why aren't we all dead?
I know. Wasn't it? When are we supposed to die? 5G beam supposed to activate the nanobots that make us all die?
I don't know. Ask JFK Jr.'s ghost. He'll probably he knows all the answers. Okay. That's
you
want
to hear something really weird though? You know what one of River Phoenix's first parts was? Was playing RFK Jr. in a RFK TV movie.
What?
Okay. Yeah, it's like a little kid, like 9 or 10.
Okay.
So River Phoenix once played RFK Jr. Fast forward 30 years from now. what the fuck is happening?
Yeah, he wasn't ever even got it. Died at 23 and still played RFK. It's impressive. All right, that about ends the show. Patreon.com/LaserTime. You can support us. $5. Tell a friend about the show. Thanks for listening. We're going to close out with one of my favorite jams, Satellite of Love by Lou Reed. Just gave you more information than you'll need. It's just an enjoyable song. But yes, we'll see you next week.